This is the speaker.
Answers to oral questions continue. Question 265 of 2012, the Honourable S.M.V.S.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Will the Minister with responsibility for the environment provide details of the technical explanations received as to why fuel solutions have not worked to solve the Western Beach problem, as reportedly discussed at the Chief Minister's meeting with La Linea Mayor, Ms. Gemma Arau?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, may I first apologise for my voice. I am suffering from a cold. And I will answer this question together with question 266.
Question 266.
So, Mr. Speaker, in light of the meeting held by the Chief Minister with the La Linea Mayor, Gemma Araujo, can the Minister for the Environment confirm whether any agreement has been reached with the said Mayor in respect of progressing towards a solution to the Western Beach pollution issue?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Health and the Environment.
Speaker, the technical solution to this issue is that the illegally polluted discharges from the storm water drain should not discharge into the sea. And in order for this to occur, La Linea needs to be able to invest in works to their system. The poor state of the La Linea economy has made an investment of this nature almost impossible, even though the present mayor would clearly like to be in a position to do so. Government has concluded that under the circumstances, pursuing a solution with the regional authority, as was the previous administration's preference, will not lead to this. It has therefore decided that it is Spain's central government that needs to be made responsible and press for a solution, and an official complaint will be lodged with the EU to this effect.
Mr. Speaker, I am grateful to the Honourable Minister for his answer. However, he's failed to address the point of what technical solutions have not worked previous to this meeting.
The fact is that the technical solutions would be almost impossible in one respect, in the sense that there are illegal connections to the storm drain, and the technical solution would be to cut off those illegal connections. Also, any works which would have to be carried out to take the effluent from the point at which they enter the sea to a point far enough away where they wouldn't cause contamination would be more costly than it appears that La Linea authorities are able to cost. Those are the solutions which they're. One is very difficult because it's a question of illegal connections and obviously the costs that would incur. It's not for me to make excuses for the La Linea authorities. I'm just reporting the facts.
Just by way of an aside to this matter, I have been made aware over the last few days of what appears to be some works in the area of that storm drain. I wonder whether the Minister is aware of any action being taken at this time?
No, I'm not aware, and if they have decided to progress any works, then obviously we would welcome that, but that has not come to us officially. There may be works which are not related to that, even though they are in the area, but certainly I would endeavour to find out as soon as possible.
I'm grateful, Speaker. If I might, just in terms of information, the government has also been made aware of those works. They do not appear to be of the nature that would suggest that they are designed to deal with the problem, although they may be designed to deal with ancillary problems arising in that storm drain. I'm grateful to the Honourable the Chief Minister for his participation in the answer. I understand that this is a matter that has complicated cross-border cross-border dimensions to it. Thank you. However, in January we were told that the matter was being reviewed, that legal advice had been sought, and then in February that the advice had been received and was being considered, and would be considered, and I quote, for a considerable length of time. I obviously now, in light of this meeting and the decision that the government appears to have taken in respect of the matter, would the minister agree with me that it is now of the highest priority to pursue this complaint with the central government in Madrid to try and progress the matter before the rainy season is upon us?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. In 2010, I wasn't a member of this parliament, but I have checked Hansard in relation to my preparation for this question. In 2010, the then government were not sure what the source of the pollution was. In 2011, when the issue was raised again by the then opposition, it had become clear to them that it was pollution proceeding from this drain in the La Linea area. And the government at the time was of the opinion that it had to proceed with discussion with the regional authority first and then consider taking legal action. I am aware from my officials that certain steps were taken, but they were made aware also that it was unlikely that the regional authorities were going to take any steps, and that's where it was left. When I came into my responsibilities for the environment, we wanted to confirm that those steps with the regional authorities were not going to get us anywhere, hence the discussions with the mayor of La Linea, and that was within 2.5 months of our coming into office, and within about a month we have now got all the documentation, all the data updated. I have seen the report today, and I'm having a meeting with Mr. Yamas next week in order to make the complaint with the EU in the shortest possible time. It is, in fact, imminent.
Mr. Speaker, I commend the Honourable Minister for the action that's being taken in respect of this matter, which is obviously one of great concern to the community. Is he in a position, however, to say to this House whether he anticipates the problem will be solved in a specific time frame, or is this simply just out of his hands and the community will be unfortunately without a resolution in this matter for some time to come?
Yes, I don't want to waste the Parliament's time in looking for the precise quote when a similar question was asked a year ago of the then Chief Minister. But it is unlikely that this will be resolved in a very short space of time.
I am grateful for
question 267, the Honourable S.M. Figueras.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, can the Minister with responsibility for the environment provide this House with details in relation to the ape population of Gibraltar, broken down by births, deaths, and location over the last 4 years?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested by the Honourable Member is contained in the schedule which I now hand to him.
Question 268, the Honourable S.M. Figueres.
Can the Minister for the Environment confirm what plans, if any, have been put in place by his government, beyond what was already in place on the 8th of December 2011, to deal with the issues faced on a daily basis by many members of the community arising from the size, distribution and behaviour of the Barbary ape population?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Health and the Environment.
Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 2.
Question
69, can the Minister for the Environment provide details of his government's policy for the management of the Barbary Ape population in Gibraltar, as well as further details of the costs of the measures anticipated?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr Speaker, no new systems have yet been introduced since December 2011, although contracted staff continue to attend when called. However, complaints in the past 3 months have been few. The government's policy for the future management of the Barbary macaques is based on the Barbary Macaque Management Plan, which was presented to the then Chief Minister in the autumn of 2009, but which was never agreed nor implemented by the then government. This plan was prepared by representatives of the Gibraltar Veterinary Clinic, the Gibraltar Ornithological and Natural History Society, and the Department of the Environment, with the involvement of the Gibraltar Tourist Board. The plan will be updated and re-costed following consultation with the team that prepared the plan and with Professor Agustin Fuentes of Notre Dame University, Indiana, who is a world expert on macaques and has worked in Gibraltar. Professor Fuentes is currently in the field in the Far East and will visit Gibraltar shortly. Once the plan has been updated, it will be made public. However, I can say that the main components will be improving the sites on the Upper Rock, increasing on-site supervision, observation and data collection, contraception and, as far as possible, exportation.
In the context of the exportation of the apes, is the Minister able to confirm whether there are any willing entities which have been identified to receive any of the Barbary apes?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. In fact, there was an entity which, for possible commercial reasons, I will not name, but I'm happy to give the information to the Honourable Member outside this House. There were approaches from one entity, the United Kingdom, which didn't come to fruition, and we have re-engaged with them to see whether there are possibilities, and the possibility of sending macaques back to North Africa. Tunisia possibly, now that the political situation there has changed, and Morocco certainly are still being considered, and contacts are once again being made with a view to the possibility of sending some of our surplus animals to North Africa.
Mr. Speaker, is the Minister, the Honourable Minister, able to commit to a period of time during which this may occur?
No, Mr. Speaker, at this stage, I am not. It's a complex issue, particularly in North Africa. There are many different levels of authorities there that have to be engaged, and at this point in time, it's too early, but I will share that information with this House as soon as anything is certain, because I think it's something which is in the interest of the whole community.
Has the Honourable Minister, managed to overcome the issues that the previous administration was facing in respect of the exploitation, the practical aspects of the exploitation of the apes?
This is a problem that I have personally been dealing with through several administrations, and the problems are not yet overcome. The problems are several. I have no problem with sharing them with the House. One is the inability or difficulty of getting them through the land frontier, and the other is the fact that none of the airlines currently servicing Gibraltar will take animals on their flights, and therefore one has to resort to either transport by sea, which could be very long and not satisfactory for animals in boxes, or chartering of aircraft, which are issues which obviously increase the costs of any such exportation. In the discussions with the UK entity, it would be hoped that perhaps there could be co-funding. In the question of North Africa, we haven't got that far yet.
Is the Minister confident then that the issues arising from the practical exportation of the apes are ones that will be overcome in due time?
Yes, in as much as when when the present minister was working in an ungovernmental organization, even though for a long time there was a lot of goodwill from the government at the time, I was not personally in a position to move certain things that I hope, as a minister and with the backing of my my colleagues in the cabinet, I will be able to make some inroads. But obviously, the proof of the pudding, as the saying goes, will be in the eating.
Is the minister able to confirm whether or not, and I understand that you are in early stages of discussing the matter with the UK entity in question, but is the Honourable Minister able to confirm to this House whether they are interested in sufficiently large numbers of the population as would make a significant impact on the local population?
Yes, they are. The discussions, as far as I was involved with the previous administration, although mainly with the Honourable Mr. Rito, who is not here in this chamber any longer, and is now lucky enough to have time to be on the stage, which is something I won't be doing for a while, I suspect. The intention was that they would take one group initially of up to 30 animals, followed by a second group of up to 30 animals, and quite frankly, if we were able to export two groups like that, the situation would be back to a very, very manageable level. So it would be useful if we could pull it off.
Mr. Speaker, I suspect this House will be as close as we both get to the stage for some time to come. I am grateful to the Minister for his answer. In relation to the numbers, is the government committed to a specific number in relation to the management of the population?
Mr. Speaker, numbers will not necessarily solve the problem. The aim of successive governments, ever since Professor Bob Martin, then of Turing University, now of Chicago Field Museum, carried out his survey some years ago, I forget the exact year, the recommendation was that 180 should be the maximum number. And the number at the moment is about, give or take, five animals per group, because it's not possible to be exact. You're always going to miss some. And I'm referring to the schedule from the previous question. It's now down to about 186. But it's not just numbers as such, because if you have one group of 30 animals which are stable and they're on the upper rock, then that's not going to be a problem. You could have a smaller group of 10, 15 animals that decide to roam, and then you're going to get a problem. So it's not just the absolute numbers, but the composition and the behavior. So although the numbers are approximately what the scientists say we should have, the question now is where those numbers are, and that is where the management issues come in.
Mr. Speaker, perhaps you'll indulge me this one question, which may perhaps include an element of speculation, and the Minister will decide whether or not he chooses to answer it. If for any reason, practical, economical, or otherwise, the government were unable to move on the process of exporting up to, say, 60 Boeing Max, how would the government propose to deal with the population as it grows in light of their stated position on culling?
I think there was an argument on speculation earlier on in this session. I am not going to accept failure at this stage. All I can do is confirm that we can control movement. We can control the problem of where the animals go to without culling. And that would be our aim if we couldn't export. Controlling the way they... Control is a very strong word. You can't really control a wild animal, but manage in such a way that the likelihood of them coming into contact with areas of human habitation would be reduced. But we're not contemplating culling.
You see, Mr. Speaker, the only reason why I ask the question is because if their likeliness on warning signs all over the upper rock is to be believed, Barbary macaque is a dangerous wild animal, and there have been stated instances of attacks on the human population, which of course have been discussed in this House in previous sessions. And it is a concern certainly on this side of the House, and I
and I fully believe that it is shared across the floor, that incidents of that nature should be, as far as possible, a thing of the past. And it is this side of the House's position that the policy of not culling at all, no matter what, may lead us to a situation where it is not a management. Hence the question. But I completely concede that it was involved speculation.
I have no problem in commenting on that. It's not the numbers. It's what the animals are doing. It's where they are. It's the interaction. It's the way people interact with them. It's normally people that cause the bites, not the animals. So what we have to control is the man-animal, the man-barbie-macaque interface, and the management plans that we are going to be introducing will tackle that regardless of the numbers. You could have one group of 20 monkeys, and if they're treated in the wrong way and they're in the wrong place, they're going to bite. I can say that there is scientific research, which I don't have here, I could if I had noticed, which indicate that the percentage of bites in Gibraltar is the lowest of that of any population where monkeys and humans come together. That research, in fact, has been carried out by Professor Fuentes, who will shortly be here on his way back from the Far East to advise us further.
The plans for management, which the Honourable Minister has just referred to, is there a timescale on that?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, we are starting our consultation process on the question of the Upper Rock management within the next 2 weeks, and the question of the Barbary macaques will be considered in tandem with the rest of the Upper Rock. So I think we would be able to have something in place within the next maybe 3-4 months. I'm not going to be held to that timescale, but that is a timescale that I would like to see and the way I see it as it's developing at the moment.
Mr. Speaker, is the Minister able to enlighten this House as to the kind of cost that the government is contemplating is almost the ceiling in this matter? Because the Honourable the Chief Minister did refer in a question in a session in 2009 to the fact that the then administration needed to take stock and invest a significant amount of money in this particular issue. Has the Minister or the government taken a moment to consider where the ceiling might be in relation to those costs?
Yes, I have an idea of the costs, but because it depends on which final model of management we follow, and because I still think that we could benefit from our external advisor, I don't feel I'm in a position to offer any actual figure at this stage, but as soon as we have an idea, then obviously I will be able to do so. But I don't think it would be correct for me. It's too early a stage now to be able to commit myself to figures.
And if Mr. Speaker will indulge me, just one more supplementary on the matter. The Honourable the Chief Minister in this very House some years ago referred to having not been gutless for a long time and therefore not an avid beach goer. I am not gutless and haven't been for as long as I can recall. And if my gut ever had that loud a say in my life, I'd scarcely leave the House. That said, I am an avid beach goer, and I'm interested whether the Minister can enlighten us as to whether the complaints received, although low in number, have been in respect of the Catherine Bay area at all.
No, Mr.
Speaker, it has been mooted, in fact only this morning to me, that the Barbary macaques might well be members of the Gibraltar Socialist Labour Party, because since the election there have been remarkably few complaints. I have seen them myself in the area of the Caleta Hotel, and I have seen them myself in the Trafalgar Cemetery area, but I have not had any direct complaints, bar possibly two. Mr. Peter would be amused that they came to me by Facebook of Barbary macaques in built-up areas, but I would like to credit the people who manage them that perhaps being former colleagues of mine, they're putting in an extra bit of work, or perhaps the Macaques are party members, if not of the DSNP, maybe of the Liberals. But the complaints are certainly much lower than they have been.
And just to bring the tone of the conversation right back to the seriousness with which, obviously, we consider the matter, is the government content to stand by its policy not to cull, if that means the possibility of facing fatalities or injuries in future?
Mr. Speaker, the government is content to stand by its policy of not culling because we are not going to have a problem once we have put in the proper management structures which have not ever existed in Gibraltar.
So long as that is a guarantee with somewhat more strength in the future job strategy, thank you very, very grateful.
May I, Mr. Speaker, because...
Yes, the Honourable Edwin Ray.
Yes, the Honourable Minister referred in his answer to question 269, referred us back to the schedule he offered on 267. When it says here, and it says, for example, 2011, 2012, and then 2012, 2013, are we talking about financial years, or when does a year, is it the 1st of April like a financial year, or when would the year come in? I'm a bit confused.
Yes, I think that by looking up the last century, the thing is that the young of the year are added to the total on the 1st of January because they are born around about October, and there are some deaths. We don't add all the contractors. Used to be, isn't me any longer. The contractors don't add the numbers until 2000, for example. Until the 1st of January. So, in the case, for example, let's look at the first one. We are talking about 2008, although the actual figures when you tally up would be on the 1st of January 2009. So, the births were in 2008, but the number is added in 2009. So, look at the first figure rather than the last figure.
Can the Minister advise us as well, he's aware what the nature of the complaints are? He stated that there are a few, but do you know what the nature of the complaints are?
There weren't complaints as such, other than being advised that there were macaques in built-up areas and people are often scared of them. But I can't recall anything specific like has happened in the past of them getting into people's houses. I'm not saying it hasn't happened, I'm just saying that I have not been aware of any such complaints. But that doesn't mean it couldn't happen tomorrow as I speak. Remember, we haven't implemented the programme yet.
Question two.
The Honourable Dave, proceed. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Which authority would be normally the authority that that would be receipt of those complaints? Can the Minister advise me what the position is?
There have in the past, as part of the management programme, we would like to streamline that. But in the past, phone calls could come in to the Royal Gibraltar Police, to officials of the Department of the Environment, to members of the Macaque team of the Natural History Society, including myself personally. So there are a wide range of different sources of complaints, which would then all be channeled to the Department of the Environment. Those are the main sources. We would like to have something like a hotline or something like that, but that would be part of the plan.
The important issue I wanted to address from my question was that it would be challenged to the Minister's department, Mr. Speaker. And he's
yes,
confirmed that it has, and I'm satisfied by the answer. I'm grateful.
There's been no one referred to hospital because of any incidents with macaques. I do recall a letter from Ray Pilley referring to a girl that had been badly injured as a consequence. There's been no incidents of that nature, has there?
There may have been. People who are bitten will normally go to the hospital and they keep a register. If any of the honourable members wish to ask me for a future occasion how many bites there has been, that I don't have that information. I'm told that one was before the election, so obviously
what was the incident?
No, less important.
Ask ourselves about the previous speaker, if you think the management of the age today, this is what we're discussing.
And
this is precisely why it is very important to have this discussion in this house.
Question two.
Just to dispel any notion or any misunderstanding, my recollection of the letter that the Honourable Mr. Peter has referred to was, in fact, in relation to a fictitious incident that he created simply to illustrate a particular point, but it was entirely fictitious.
Mr. Speaker, I can assist the House and concur with what the Honourable Minister is saying. I think that was just an introductory paragraph in Mr. Pitty's letter in order to create the alarm initially, and therefore create, I suspect I haven't spoken to the author, but to create the interest in what he was saying. I would agree with that. So I'm not sure that he was referring to any specific incident, whether before or after the new dawn arrived.
Question 270, the Honourable S.M. Figueras.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the Minister need not wince. I am not armed with a barrage of supplementaries on this one. Can the Minister, with responsibility for the environment, confirm the government's policy in relation to the management and control of the seagull population?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Speaker, Mr. Figueras can ask me. The Honourable Mr. Figueras can ask me as many supplementaries as he likes, but if my voice runs out before the Honourable Mr. Dalul has a chance to ask me any questions, then I might have to get somebody else to read my answers. Mr. Speaker, the existing year-round culling programme will continue with enhanced resources currently under discussion with the service providers. Government inherited a four-year programme from the previous administration, which is run by the UK's Food and Environment Research Agency. This is the last year in this programme, which has now been considerably streamlined and would factor in an element of handing over and training to the local operation, which will take over in full. New technologies, which have proved very successful elsewhere, will also be introduced this year. The government is committed for the long-term control and reduction of the gull population.
Mr. Speaker, has the minister been able? Is the minister able to enlighten us in respect of the identity of the local operators who will be taking this matter on?
Yes, the local operators who have been operating the gull control unit for the last 15 years are the Gibraltar Ethnological and Natural History Society.
In respect to the cost, which is obviously a theme in the questioning, is the Minister able to assist us in respect of the anticipated cost moving forward of this operation versus perhaps what has gone before?
I would have had to have notice to give you details of cost. I can pass them over to you outside the meeting if you like, but I don't have that information here.
Yes, if he wants notice of the question, we'll ask it in a month's time. It really is not... not contentious in any way, but I have noted in my walks in the Upper Rock that there are a very large number, or appear to be a very large number of feral cats, and I wonder what the government proposes to do about feral cats, whether he thinks there's an impact or a potential impact on wildlife. And I think also that he and I have spoken in the past about the resident population of goats and what is the government to do about the goats, because he knows that we have spoken as well in the past about the possible reintroduction of the Iberian ibex, which is not possible unless something is done about the herd of domestic goats that are running wild in the Upper Rock.
I'm not sure the connection between feral cats and goats and seagulls, but if the Minister wishes to...
Mr. Speaker, if I fall into the temptation of giving a lecture on the wildlife of the Upper Rock, then we might be here for several days, let alone hours. And I'm happy to answer specific questions in the future, but opening a discussion on those subjects, I think is... But to talk about it outside, second person today is offered you a...
expressing
the Honourable.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, can the Minister explain how is GONS going to be taking over the service that was introduced by the UK? What measures will be taken? Any new ones?
Right, yes. There will be a considerable amount of training, which for the first time has been organised by the people from FERA, the Food and Environment Research Agency, with the control unit here, with a view to, depending on the success, expanding the size of the unit. And the question of new technologies, we will be trying, and God will be trained in this new technology, which is the use of lasers to disrupt gulls at their breeding colonies, which means they will abandon the nests, then there won't be the number of young, which is obviously a problem, and eventually, if this is successful, it's been tried in the UK, but never outside the UK, perhaps in the United States, then it may be possible to reduce the population of gulls without resorting to killing them directly, which would be the ideal situation.
Question 271. The Honourable Mrs. I.M. Alul-Hamp.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain what the policy, in conjunction with the care agency, is to further and adequately increase the overall provision for dementia and Alzheimer patients, as outlined in their press release number 32 of 17th of January 2012?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the Ministers with the responsibility for health, social services and the care agency have commissioned a multi-agency team which will work in regular consultation with relevant non-governmental organisations and which will report by the end of the summer on a strategy to address the core needs of those with dementia.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister explain if he has plans to boost the community health service and domiciliary care?
Mr. Speaker, it is highly likely that the conclusions of this group, this multi-agency team, and as I have declared in conversations and possibly even publicly, will be that the community will be well benefited by increasing health care in the community, including domiciliary care. I don't want to preempt the results, but I think it is very clear to those of us, both the Minister for Equality and Social Services and myself have discussed this at length, that it will most likely be necessary for us to take considerable steps in the community.
Mr. Speaker, is the Minister aware that the domiciliary care funding increased by about 400% over the last 5 years to £750,000? By how much does he envisage or would like to see the domiciliary care budget increase this year?
Mr. Speaker, domiciliary care is handled by another ministry. I do not have insight, although we discuss regularly. Obviously, I don't have insight into the proposed budget and so on. I cannot answer that. But what I can say is that we hope to be able to expand it, but I cannot go into figures at that stage. I don't have that information.
Question 272, the Honourable Mrs. I.M. Abdul-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain how the £70,000 has been spent at the KG5 hospital, broken down by painting of the building, erection and hire of scaffolding, and purchase of new equipment and furniture for the KG5?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the spend to date and committed expenditure for the renovation programme at the KG5 hospital is as follows. Painting external building, 2,765, spent, 8,000 committed. Internal paintwork, 1,000 committed. Scaffolding, 7,800 spent. External plumbing, 500 spent, 1,500 committed. Refurbishment of male and female toilets, 13,145 spent. Ceiling tile renewal, £2,820.38 spent. Ironmongering, 3,380 spent. General building materials, 2,405.09 spent. new suspended seating in the dining area of the Long State Ward, 1,500 committed. New treatment room, 1,600 spent. New isolation room, 2,340 spent. Furniture, 4,069 spent. The following are committed, subject to final receipt of all the estimates that have been requested, because these are the last few things that are going to be done, and that is curtain rail, 7,000 committed, subject to quotes, privacy wall mounted partitions, 7,000, main entrance flooring, 2,000, new signage, 1,000, repairs to windows, 2,000, renewal of entrance wrap, 3,000. Total spent to date, £40,824.47. Committed expenditure, £34,000. Total expected expense of the project, £74,824.47 spent. I would like to take this opportunity to congratulate the team in the Health Authority for their exemplary work in having all this work done to schedule.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for that information. Could the Minister extend a copy of that schedule to the members opposite?
Question 273, the Honourable Mrs. I. M. L. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain what changes will be made to the former Royal Naval Hospital site and to the plans for the internal buildings of the new Mental Health Hospital and of the new Alzheimer Dementia Hospital?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, as this is something in which my colleague, the Honourable Minister for Equality and Social Services, and I are working together. If, with your permission, we will answer this question in two parts. My colleague will start on her side of the project, and I will continue on mine.
Certainly.
Mr. Speaker, with regard to the Alzheimer and Dementia Unit, as I have said in the previous sessions of Parliament, a review of the initial proposed 80-bed facility for the site of the Royal Naval Hospital was commenced very shortly after this government began in office. And it was very evident that the facility fell short of UK minimum standards, even taking into account the conversion of existing buildings into this type of facility. I can at this stage say that the number of beds will be reduced to incorporate communal facilities to allow residents accommodation in the facility to have quality of life. The final layout of the interior has not yet been finalised as we are awaiting input from experts.
Mr. Speaker, I will now continue I have a little bit more because we've been able to proceed further on the mental health. Regarding the mental health facility, the plans were incomplete and had not been approved by the professionals. The professional team has now reviewed all aspects, and I was pleased to be able to sign off proper plans last month. The area designated for mental health will be divided into three main zones. First is the activity and rehabilitation centre zone, which will include a small garden area attached to the back of Block D. The area will consist of activity for daily living, kitchen, assessment room, arts and crafts room, IT facilities room, bookable rooms for conducting groups, sitting room, quiet area and dining room. Second, the psychiatric unit zone on the lower ground floor will consist of main entrance, reception security area, visitors facilities consisting of visitation area, cafeteria offering sheltered employment facilities and seating area, multidisciplinary team room, resource room, medical record storage room, clinical nurse manager's office, pharmacy department, disabled toilet facilities, technical services workshop, staff facilities, outpatient department, workshops, general stores, medical equipment stores, domestic equipment store, and boiler room. The upper ground floor, which will be for enduring mental health, illness, and the dementia unit, will consist of 7 twin rooms of 14 beds, clearly. Dining area, lounge TV area, quiet rooms, male and female assisted bathrooms, male and female toilet and shower rooms, staff office, staff base, multidisciplinary team room, clinic room, utility sluice room, clean linen store, staff WC, food preparation room, dishwashing room, ward kitchenette and cupboard terrace. And the first floor will be the rehab unit and the rehab apartments, divided into two sections by a lobby. The first section with 4 twin bedrooms, 4 single bedrooms, one high dependency bedroom with 13 beds, lounge TV area, quiet room, assisted bathroom, male and female, toilet and shower room, staff office, staff base, clinic room, utility sluice room, clean linen store, staff toilet, ward kitchenette and cupboard terrace, including a dining area. The second section of this floor will have the psychiatric intensive care unit, which will consist of 3 single rooms and ensuite facilities, a staff base, 2 high dependency rooms, dining area, lounge TV area, covered terrace area, and also self-contained multifunctional suite composed of 2 single rooms, dining area, lounge TV area, toilet and shower facilities. And finally, the external recreational area, which is still in the process of being designed. However, it will be a secure area divided into 2 sections in order to be able to offer a safe environment to the various client groups. It will contain sheltered areas, splash pool, an aviary, a one-on-one basketball court, exterior exercise equipment, group seating, picnic chair and table facilities.
I'm grateful for that, Mr. Speaker. Could we possibly have a copy of that?
Certainly.
Now, could the Minister advise what additional costs these changes will incur?
Mr. Speaker, I haven't got that information with me now. Again, I will need notice of that in order to be able to give you the specific details.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister advise what is different to the original plans that were there?
There were no plans that had been approved. They were working plans. They hadn't been finalised by the professionals. The main difference is that the rooms will in fact be bigger than had originally been planned.
Can he confirm whether there are going to be any additional costs? Or because, of course, it's quite possible that you may actually change around internal layouts from what was originally envisaged, but there be no additional costs. Does he know whether there are going to be additional costs without actually telling this House what that additional cost is?
The original costs have not ever been communicated to me, so I am not able to compare one with the other, so I am not able to answer that question. The original estimates can't have been very accurate because the plans hadn't been finalised.
Well, that doesn't necessarily follow, but we will ask the question again in the future. But what about the Honourable Lady? Can she tell us whether the change of plans that she envisages in relation to the areas that are within her responsibility will involve an increase in costs? And can she inform the House as to what those costs are?
Mr. Speaker, I cannot inform the House as to the costs because the plans have not yet been finalised. What I would speculate that some cost would be incurred, but in proportionate terms, Mr. Speaker, it would be desirable to incur some cost and have a better finished product than incur the tremendous cost that will be incurred in any event, ending up with a product that will not be fit for purpose. But at this stage, I am not able to provide any figures on costs because we do not have the plans, therefore we cannot calculate from them.
Mr. Speaker, could the Honourable Lady advise who the proper consultants are who they have engaged in relation to advice on the Alzheimer's and Dementia Unit?
Mr. Speaker, I do not have the name of the consultant. It is people in the department who are liaising with these consultants. I know that they are people that were recommended to us from the local Alzheimer and Dementia Society who gave us some contact details for the UK Association, and they recommended us with some names. I'm not sure who from the list of names has been selected, but I'm happy for the question to be asked on the next occasion. If I were to have notice of the question, Mr. Speaker, I would be happy to answer it.
Mr. Speaker, can I ask the Honourable Lady, the Minister for Social Services, because she said that in the new plans for the Dementia and Alzheimer Hospital, the number of beds will come down from 80, but what she did not say was to what number will the new plans cater for. Does she have that figure available?
No, Mr. Speaker, that is because I don't know, because I am waiting on the final plans to be confirmed by the specialists in the UK. What we have identified, as I explained, Mr. Speaker, in the last session of Parliament, was that initially the plan was for a 66-bed unit. That was changed four times, eventually going up to a 90-something bed unit, and then going back down to 80, which were the sort of structure that I saw when I went to visit the unit in my second day in office, and which I was told by the local people that would not be fit for purpose. And I gave plenty of detail as to that on the last occasion. And in fact, I have asked for the costs of the consequences of having changed the plans four times by the previous administration, and I'm actually waiting for those figures. But the answer is that there is no final plan for the interior yet because we are waiting for the feedback.
I can accept that there is no final plans in terms of final plans being the exact minutiae of details of what that needs to be done. But the Honourable Lady does not need final plans in a construction project to be able to tell us, and for her to know now, what the number of beds will be. None of the... The Honourable Lady says, for instance, that the previous government changed its mind four times, she should be congratulating the GSD government for only changing its mind four times, because if the Honourable Lady knew anything about the construction industry, would know that any particular construction project, right, the government normally changes mind many times, architects change his mind many times, engineers change his mind many times, and the actual contractor involved in the work changes his time. So it's a matter of record that we only change four times. Leaving that aside, it's not credible for the Honourable Lady to stand up saying that she needs final plans to know what the final numbers of bed it is, because we knew in the four times that she was mentioning the number of beds that were going to be available without final plans. That is the reality of the construction industry. So will the Honourable Lady not try and get information as to what will be the final number of beds, regardless of having final plans?
Mr. Speaker, once I have the cost to the taxpayer of those four changes, then people can decide whether to congratulate the previous administration for those changes. I suspect not, because I suspect, given the information that I have, Mr. Speaker, the reasons for changing the plans was motivated by increasing the number of beds, having no regard to the need of the patients. Mr. Speaker, what we have done in principle is revert to the initial plans that the architects prepared for the previous administration, which was for a 66 bed unit. What we are waiting for is for the experts to tell us whether the layout is acceptable or not, because it may be very well, Mr. Speaker, for us to have a room where we want to fit a bed. But then if the hoist or the armchair or the wardrobe don't fit into the room, then the plans cannot be finalized. I therefore cannot say whether I can have one room with one bed, or it may be better to have a bigger room with two beds, in which case there is a difference in the number of rooms, and ultimately there will be a difference in the number of beds available. The answer, Mr. Speaker, is that until we do not have the final professional advice, I cannot answer the question. All I can say is that at the moment we have reverted to the initial 66 bed plan.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain their idea behind developing extra buildings to serve as sheltered accommodation for patients with long-term mental illness? Will this also be done in conjunction with the plans for the new mental health hospital?
Are you referring to something specifically in what I...
No, sorry.
In your manifesto commitment as part of the new mental health facility?
Can you refer me exactly to
it says extra buildings to serve as sheltered accommodation for patients with long-term mental illness on page 29, the second last sentence. Sorry, we are committed to the completion of a new KGY facility and will also develop extra buildings to serve as sheltered accommodation for patients with long-term mental illness in a position to look after themselves.
There are additional buildings on that site, but whether that will fulfill all the requirements of the community, we are hoping that the exercise that I referred to earlier on another question, as we develop the dementia strategy, then we will identify what those requirements would be. They could be somewhere else.
Question 274, the Honourable Mrs. I. M. Elul Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health state at what stage he is at in relation to the consultant's contract, and when does he envisage it will be finalised and signed as per the manifesto commitment to resolve the issue of the consultant's contracts in the shortest time possible?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the consultant's contract was first drafted in 2004, and by December 2011, had arrived at version 19B. The DHA has now updated the draft and will very soon be in active negotiations with its consultant doctors. The consultants have been kept aware of the situation through regular meetings.
I'm obliged for that, Mr. Speaker. And can the Minister explain if the starting point in resolving the consultant contract impasse is draft contract 19B?
That was the finishing point of the last administration. Ours is the new contract draft one, which incorporates some of the things that were being negotiated at the time, together with other issues, which we feel would be to our mutual benefit. But obviously, before the start of negotiation, I am not going to be able to reveal those publicly.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister explain if we will be considering including a recruitment and retainment allowance within the contract?
I don't feel that I should go specifically into items of a contract just before we are going to negotiate them with the consultant body. I don't think it would be in our interest or in the interest of the consultant that we should start discussing this in public.
I'm grateful for that, Mr. Speaker, but perhaps could the Minister in general terms give an indication of what aspects of the contract will be standardised across all the consultants and which ones will be variable if possible?
Different consultants will have different disciplines in which they will work. Some of them will have a number of consultants in the same field, and some of them may have rarely one, possibly two consultants. So obviously, when it comes to cover and so on, there may be different conditions. But I don't want to be drawn into giving away a negotiating position, because as I said before, I don't think this would be fair on the process. And it's in everybody's interest that the consultants should have a contract which is acceptable to them and acceptable to the government, so they can stop worrying about that and get on with doing the work that we want them to do for the community.
I'm grateful for that. One final supplementary question, Mr. Speaker. Did you state when you envisage the contract would be finalised and if the process has already started in earnest?
The draft contract is now ready and we hope to be starting negotiation within a number of weeks only.
Question 275, the Honourable Mrs. Aya Manul Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain what the new arrangements for hospital meals will be as per their manifesto commitment to make alternative arrangements to improve the delivery of meals and consequently their quality?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, a proposal presented by the catering department to revert to bulk meal service at St. Bernard's Hospital has been approved, and initial discussions have taken place in order to phase in this service. This has already been introduced as a highly successful trial at the newly opened Calvert Ward. A feasibility study to relocate the catering facility to St. Bernard's Hospital has also been commissioned and is progressing well. This project will encompass the introduction of bulk food distribution.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister explain why there was a problem with the provision of meals in St. Bernard's Hospital?
Yes, at this point I'd like to congratulate the catering staff of St. Bernard's Hospital. They have always been very concerned that hospital meals did not have a good name. Despite their excellent professionalism, they have a catering manager who is extremely highly qualified and extremely competent and a very dedicated staff. But the method by which the food was delivered to the wards meant that all their efforts could well be spoiled in the process. The problem is with the plating system, in that the food is prepared in the kitchen and is then put into plates and put into trolleys and then carried by van in two stages to St. Bernard's Hospital and then from there wheeled into the wards. So by the end of the process, the food was no longer as fresh as it had been when prepared, and therefore that was a problem. By bulk food, we are referring to the way in which the food is prepared in larger containers and then served at point of consumption. And therefore, the quality of the food, which is very high, will actually be high on point of delivery, whereas in the process at this point in time, it does lose because of the system that is in operation.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister explain then where the kitchens will be sited within the hospital and what will be happening to the existing catering facility on the North Mole?
Mr. Speaker, we are carrying out an exercise at the moment with a team of the Health Authority and the support of Technical Services. A number of alternative locations within the hospital are being considered. I am not able now to say exactly where. It will not affect any of the existing facilities, in the sense that we're not moving anybody out to move the kitchen in. there is spare room available in and adjacent to the building. As to what would happen in the North Bow, I am not in a position to say that because, frankly, I don't know.
Does the Minister have any idea what the cost of this initiative will amount to at this stage?
No, Mr. Speaker, we are engaging with the catering department, as I have said, with the management of the hospital and with technical services. They now know the surface area that they require, the different sections that they require, and so on. But because the site isn't exactly, although we have a fair idea of where it will go, but we are not yet at the point of knowing exactly how much it will cost, I think that we'll be able to know. I think, it's a matter of weeks before we know that. The discussions are well on their way.
Question 276, the Honourable Mrs. Aya Madul-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain how their policy on ensuring all GHA doctors are GMC registered will work?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, I have met with the Medical Registration Board and we are working together in drafting new legislation to encompass this. We have also taken steps to meet with GMC representatives to explore details of how we can establish the system. I will be able to report further once these discussions have taken place.
I'm grateful for that, Mr. Speaker, but could the Minister give us an indication of how he will be outsourcing to the GMC the assessment of doctors in Gibraltar to practice? Is there some initial idea of how the GMC could become Gibraltar's regulatory body in practice?
Not yet, Mr. Speaker. We have only very recently, I met with the board, I think it's about 2 weeks ago, we have only very recently made contact with the GMC. I needed to discuss it with the Medical Registration Board. And we have now sent out, we have made contact now with a view to meeting with them and discussing with them. But obviously we have to be professional enough to await our discussions before I say anything publicly, because they will have their views, we will have ours. But I am confident that we will be able to marry the two and come up with a way of meeting our manifesto commitment to the satisfaction not just of the doctors, but also of the health service and the community as a whole, which needs to be confident that the doctors are properly regulated.
Mr. Speaker, this is a policy move I do support to ensure that all doctors practicing in Gibraltar should be an RGMC registered. Can the Minister explain if all doctors practicing in Gibraltar, including in the private sector, in Gibraltar will also require GMC registration and yearly re-registration?
Again, I cannot speak for the GMC, but certainly the intention, I think that the community as a whole should be confident that all doctors practicing in Gibraltar, both within the health authority and outside, are properly regulated to the standards of the GMC. So I think that on this one we agree.
And finally, Mr. Speaker, what will now be the role of the Gibraltar Medical Registration Board, which is chaired by the Director of Public Health? Will its role change, or will it be taking on any of the GMC's roles?
We will have to await the discussion for the GMC before I am able to reach to reply to that question. We are just initiating contact. We need to see how we will work. And I just don't know. Hopefully in a couple of months' time, if you ask me again, I'll have some indication.
Question 277, the Honourable Mrs. Aya Madul-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain their manifesto commitment outlined on their health page under day surgery of "We will be looking into operating a day case unit for surgical services"?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, "looking into operating a day case unit for surgical services," end of quote. will entail reviewing all aspects of day surgery within the DHA so that we can optimise the use of resources available within theatres and look at opportunities in widening the range of treatments provided on this basis. We plan to look into all aspects that relate to this service, and this includes facilities, management of the unit, operational procedures, activity, current practices, and quality measures. The aim is to expand the day surgery service as much as possible without the need for overnight admission.
Mr. Speaker, in the Honourable Minister's answer to my written question number 69 of 2012, the Minister stated that the day case surgery clinic was first introduced by the GHA on the 24th of February 2005. Was the Minister not aware that a day case surgery service had already been in existence for these last 6 years when his party was writing their manifesto?
The sad thing is that the day surgery facilities are not operating to the extent that certainly I would like, or to the extent that I think would benefit the community. The day surgery system is not functioning as one would like. I had the pleasure of visiting a day surgery unit in Salisbury General Hospital a couple of weeks ago in order to discuss and look into the way they work there. And it is likely that maybe even as much as 80% of the kind of surgery we do in St. Bernard's Hospital could, if the facilities and the culture were right, be carried out by day surgery, which has various benefits, including the fact that beds are more available overnight for emergency admissions, and the fact that people spend less time in hospital and more time at home. So it's got the benefits across the board. We have to do a lot of work yet to get our day surgery facilities working at full throttle, and that is what we intend to do by tackling the matters that I referred to in my original answer.
Mr. Speaker, is the Minister not aware that there is a difference between a day surgery unit that, in their view, is not working and there not being one at all? How will the Minister improve on the so-called deficient day surgery service that exists at present, which, in his answer to my question 69, 160 patients had benefited and used this service within less than a month?
There's a difference between a unit that isn't working and none at all. But it depends on how much or how little it is working. What I am saying is that there is huge potential for developing day surgery, which is not being fulfilled at the moment, and which we want to work at improving. This will require looking into all sorts of things, including the staff that we have available, including the fact that they are geared up to day surgery, and the whole management of the unit. Therefore, I think that the judgment should come once we've taken on this initiative. It may work better or may work less well, but I'm confident that if we put in the necessary resources, we will be able to increase the number of patients who are operated in St. Bernard's without having to stay overnight.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful that you're looking into ways of improving the service. But does the Honourable Minister not concede that the service was in existence while you were writing your manifesto, and that surely you wouldn't be sending 160 patients to use a service that is not working correctly?
Mr. Speaker, I did not write the manifesto. I wasn't in politics at the time, so I cannot really answer the comment. All I can say is that
I wasn't in the college yet, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I revert to my original answer and explanation. The potential for day surgery in Gibraltar is very great. It is underutilized, and therefore we have to work hard to achieve it. And that's really all I have to say on the matter.
Question 278. The Honourable Mrs. Iam Elul-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education explain the process by which the 47 new teaching posts will be filled, and if any will be recruited to fill retired posts or specialist advisory roles within the Department of Education?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Education, Financial Services, Gaming, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the process started in December 2011. When head teachers were asked to produce a report on whole school needs. This included staffing requirements. The consultation process continued with the advisory service of the Department of Education visiting individual schools to discuss staffing issues with head teachers. The results of the exercise have helped to inform the Department of Education as to how and where the 47 new teaching posts should be allocated. The vacancies have been advertised in an official notice advising prospective applicants that interviews will commence on Monday, 2nd April 2012. Successful applicants will be in post for the start of the 2012-2013 academic year. Any teaching post left vacant due to retirement will be covered by the recruitment of teachers over and above these 47 new teachers, new posts, in keeping with the government's manifesto commitment of increasing the current teacher complement of 333 to 380. In other words, the 47 new posts will not be used to cover retirements, any retirements that occur between now and the end of this academic year or the start of the following academic year will be recruited by new posts over and above the 47. It is anticipated that at least three of the 47 new posts will go towards behaviour education support team, which to date has been staffed predominantly by supply teachers.
Thank you for that, Mr. Speaker. Can the Minister advise if any of these 47 vacancies are to be used as classroom aides positions?
No, Mr. Speaker. There is a separate question in the order paper in relation to classroom aides, but these are teachers, not classroom aides. That is a totally separate exercise that has been done in relation to classroom aids.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister advise what the government's optimum maximum number of children in classes at each level of the education system will be, where a number of these new teaching posts will be placed to achieve these optimum class sizes?
Is the Honourable Member asking what the class sizes will be or how many of the 47 will be?
The size, the number, I appreciate that perhaps I should have given notice for this.
Well, what I can say is that is a matter that I'm in discussion with the advisors of the Department of Education and the Director of Education in relation to the recruitment process of the 47 new teachers. I am undertaking an exercise whereby I have visited all schools, in fact, except for Balbeck Nursery, which is the only government school that I haven't visited yet, but I have visited all schools to see for myself the question of classroom sizes and to talk to head teachers about that. That is an ongoing process which I'm in the process of discussing with the education authorities.
Does the Minister, just so I can understand it fully, after assessing staffing requirements with the head teachers, is he aware of where these posts are going to be filled in by these 47 new recruits?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the exercise that has been done in conjunction with head teachers, taking into account their needs and following discussions with the head teachers. Tentative provisions have been made in respect of the numbers to be allocated to each school, so that exercise has been done.
Question 279, the Honourable Mrs. Iam Elul-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, as per the manifesto commitment to start within 3 months of taking office, can the Minister for Education explain at what stage his department is in relation to carrying out a review to identify what additional resources are required in each school for children with special educational needs?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education, Financial Services, Gaming, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 280 for 2012.
Question 280.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education tell us if the government is going to increase the number of classroom aides as part of their resourcing and support of children with special educational needs?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Education, Financial Services, Gaming, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the government's manifesto commitment was to identify, starting within 3 months of taking office, what additional resources are required for special educational needs for said children in each school. I can confirm that this review was started in December 2011. All head teachers have been consulted in relation to the additional required resources for special education needs that they may require. These include staffing, environmental adaptations, and equipment. The data received is now being processed. The review has already identified a need for extra classroom aides. As an immediate step, 15 part-time classroom aides, in other words, 15 classroom aides who currently work part-time, who have asked to be considered for full-time employment, will be made full-time as from April 2012. This will have the immediate effect of increasing the overall support available for children with special educational needs. The effect, in fact, is increased by 7.5 classroom aides immediately. The engagement of further classroom aides is currently being considered because the process is ongoing, having received the data, the information and the request from the different schools. I can also confirm that the supply list for classroom aides is in the process of being repopulated and applicants have already been interviewed and they should be available to provide cover shortly. I should explain that a problem we found was that just before the election, the supply list for classroom aides has essentially been exhausted because the people on the supply list have been taken on for permanent employment, and therefore it was not possible when classroom aides were off sick or had engagements, it was not possible to get supply classroom aides to come in to do that temporary cover. I understand that the previous administration was in the process of advertising or had advertised for that supply list. We have continued that process. Interviews had taken place and the successful applicants to go on the list will be on the list shortly and will be available to provide cover. The Department of Education and the Care Agency are also working together on collating data with reference to pupils with disabilities. The aim here is to look at the future needs of young people and children as they progress through the education system and on to the adult world.
I'm grateful for that. Mr. Speaker, is the Minister aware that a full review of classroom aides was conducted by the former Director of Education just before the elections? I'm not sure if you are using that report. And he submitted new salary scales, job descriptions, and made recommendations. Whether that review has been looked at and is being implemented as part of the plan of making 15 part-time aides full-time?
No, Mr. Speaker, the answer that I've given is in relation to the review in respect of additional resources, which is something separate from reviewing the contract and the terms of engagement of classroom aides. This is something that I started in December 2012 with a face-to-face meeting with all head teachers and asked them specifically for their requirements, both in respect of staffing so that they could do the exercise with 47 teachers and also in respect for special educational needs, as well as other matters such as maintenance and buildings and all those matters were discussed. And I asked all the teachers to produce essentially a wish list of what they would like for their schools. Having received that, that is the data that was collated. It was immediately identified that there was a need for additional classroom aides, and therefore a decision was taken to engage those classroom aides who currently were in the system working part-time, who wanted to go full-time, to engage them full-time. And we are considering what further resources are required in addition to making available supply classroom aides. But as a separate exercise, we are looking at the contract for the terms and conditions, and we expect that that process will be ready when the classroom aides are made full-time in April, so that the terms of engagement can be standardised for all classroom aides.
Speaker, can I suggest to the Honourable Minister that perhaps he ask the previous Director of Education to show you the work that had already been done so you do not have to duplicate it, just to perhaps facilitate that. Mr. Speaker, can the Minister answer how gifted children will be helped? Does he have an idea of what extra resources or work they will be received that is already over and above the differentiation of current work that is being done and any extra work that is already given to them within the classroom?
Mr. Speaker, that is a matter that is also being looked at primarily, as the Honourable Lady has identified. The matter is tackled through differentiation. Not everybody that is in the same class receives the same work and takes the same homework on the home. So pupils are differentiated, not just by being placed in bands in separate class, depending on ability, but also within the same classroom, there is differentiation that occurs. It is a matter that I have discussed with head teachers. I am informed and I'm satisfied that differentiation is working well, but we are looking at what additional help can be given. But the main process by which that is achieved is differentiation, and it is actually working.
Mr. Speaker, the government pledges for all children, you just mentioned, to be assessed for special educational needs on entry into the education system. Is the Minister aware that this assessment or psychological screening is already being conducted on all children on entry into the education system, and that the reporting system does ensure that there is continuous assessment and it stays in place? So what does the Honourable Minister envisage will be extra assessment for these children, and will there be any extra work for the teachers to take on?
Speaker, it's not a question of extra assessments. I'm certainly aware that there is an assessment panel and that children are assessed. There is a need for ongoing assessment, not just an assessment at the start of the educational life of a child, but ongoing assessment, because the needs of children can change it in one direction or another. There may be a need for a particular child to have a classroom aid a particular year and not the next year because of progress that may be made. So the assessment is and has to continue to be and has been, and that is a process that will continue. What we are also doing is not just looking at it from an educational point of view, but because we said that we want to have the assessment and continue that through the life of the educational life of the child and beyond. That is a reference that I've made of the collaboration that is taking place with the care agency at the moment, so that there is exchange of information. In effect, what there should be, what there must be in respect of children, is shared information as to information that the care agency has in respect of disabilities, because they deal with issues regarding children with disabilities, and information which the education department has in respect of the assessment panel and the assessment in respect of special needs. That information is shared so that there is, firstly, cooperation between the two agencies, the department and the agency, during the school life of the child, and support is provided to both, because in some cases we have children that are in the hands of the care agency, but they do need educational support, and we have already witnessed in the last few months a number of examples of that. And there are also children clearly within the educational system that need the support of the care agency, and that collaboration must continue on a hands-on and a shared information basis. But beyond that, what is also important is that there should not just be shared information and collaboration during the schooling years, but that at the end of the day, the child with perhaps disabilities, that is going to have continued needs for the services of the care agency, they will progress into adulthood, and there has to be a transition, and that transition has to be managed during the course of the education system, and that is why that collaboration is existing, to be able to make sure that we can manage that transition and not essentially leave a child in limbo once he leaves the education system.
Mr. Speaker, my understanding is that process already was in existence and there was already collaboration between the care agency and the Department of Education and the Health Authority. So my question to you is, how will it be different to what has already been in existence?
Mr. Speaker, I have absolutely no idea what the system was before. We came into office in December 2012 and we have decided that there has... Sorry, 2011. Thank you. And we have decided to put the system in place to make sure that exists. I am certain that there must have been some collaboration before, but it is not something that we have said, well, what existed before and let's just continue. And we have decided to talk about the needs of these children and how we can assist in working in conjunction with the two agencies to assist those children. Of course there was collaboration before. Of course there was assistance given to children with special educational needs before. And of course the Education Department did a very good job in doing that, as indeed did the care agency. What we're doing is continuing that work, perhaps enhancing that work by focusing more on that transition to adulthood. Perhaps there was I would say a failure in that respect, but possibly more needed to be done, and we are concentrating specifically on that to make sure that transition is seamless. I mean, I don't want to be critical of the previous administration. I'm here to answer for what we're doing and to explain what we're doing rather than how what we're doing is different to the previous administration. Whatever happened before happened, and we're certainly grateful for the efforts of the Department of Education and the care agency before in assisting these children, and we will continue that process and try to enhance it.
Speaker, I'm grateful for that acknowledgement, and so just to sum up, you're perhaps reviewing what is already in place, and perhaps in your mind, if you feel there could be an improvement or more resources or funding could be pumped into the service, that is what you will be doing.
Not just that, we haven't come in and said, well, let's just review what is in place and see how we can improve it. We've come with ideas as to what we want to see achieved, and we give instructions so that our system is put in place to the extent that requires thinking of what happened before. That is what is happening. It's not just a question of looking at what existed before. We've decided what we want to do and how we want to achieve it, and that's what we're putting forward.
The Honourable David Rosen. Mr. Speaker, just for my assistance, can the Minister confirm what my understanding is in terms of the review, which and I commend that the review has started, and that was one of their manifesto commitments, and I commend them for this. But the features of the review, if I could put it and summarise it in these terms, is a consultation with the head teachers, which presumably has, you have confirmed, has started and will presumably be ongoing. And secondly, there will be a data collection in relation to all children with diabetes. With disabilities, presumably. I'm thinking about something else. So it was with special needs, is that the position? I think you said disability, but that's fine, I'll accept that. So is the review going to take other features? Is it? Are you going to be looking at different things within the review they're carrying out? Yes, of course. This arises as a sort of a supplementary question made by my colleague, Mr.
Well, yes, Mr. Speaker, as I have already explained, what we are doing is looking at specifically what is required by the different schools, what the head teachers identify are either additional resources or additional facilities or additional equipment. All those matters are subject to the... And it's not a review which we say, well, we've started the review and it's going to be an ongoing review. It is a request that we made, that I made specifically, of head teachers to provide me with what those resources, both personnel resources, material resources, building resources, equipment resources, all those resources were, that, and all that has been provided. All that information has already been collated and is being looked at the moment. And it's been looked at not just for the purposes of saying, well, we're doing a review. It's been looked at with a view to implementing the additional resources which are required, which, as the Honourable Lady identified, was a manifesto commitment from us. We immediately implemented part of it by identifying a need for classroom aids, and further classroom aids will, I'm sure, will be needed and will be engaged, as well as issues relating to buildings, which we are looking at, and specifically also in relation to equipment. Equipment, not just equipment specifically for special needs, but generally equipment that is required in schools. All that is currently being looked at and will be implemented very soon.
In relation to the second feature which I identified, in relation to the data collection of children with special needs, can you expand on that? Am I right in understanding that forms part of the review? And if it's correct, what does it mean by that, by data collection?
I explained it to a certain extent before. What I specifically asked was for head teachers to provide to me a wish list of what it was that they required in terms of resources, both staffing, manning, additional classroom aids, and other kinds of resources and facilities that they required. And that is the data that has been collected in respect of those wish lists from all the individual schools, which has been put together with an emphasis on the one hand for the purposes of staffing and the 47 teachers, which we already touched upon. On the other hand, separately looking at facilities and resources which are required in respect of special needs, on which we are very interested in implementing as much of that as possible very, very quickly, and separately in relation to buildings, maintenance, refurbishment, those sorts of areas. So there are distinct areas to the collection of that data, which is in very advanced stage of having been looked at.
And if I may, Speaker, I think my honourable friend perhaps was referring to individual educational action plans for the children with special educational needs, and together with a continuous assessment, the plan will be changed and adaptations or resources will be required for the children as necessary. Is that the plan?
Well, yes, Mr. Speaker. As I said, there is an assessment panel. There are professionals in the education department that deal specifically with all these matters, and I have given them instructions to specifically look at all aspects of special educational needs and the plans that are required in respect of the children with a view to implementing all of that, as I said, very, very quickly.
Question 281, the Honourable Mrs. Ayemma Noel Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education explain their school's maintenance teams policy?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Education, Financial Services, Gaming, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the government's policy is as stated in its manifesto, namely to provide a dedicated pool of sufficiently resourced maintenance for schools. This policy is already in effect, as stated in government press release dated 15th February 2012. The system put in place consists of a team contracted from GJPS. They comprise an experienced foreman and 8 skilled operatives working exclusively in schools. They are tackling small-scale repair jobs estimated at taking less than 5 days and are liaising directly with officers from the Department of Education.
Speaker, can the Minister say if this service went out to tender or was it directly given to GJBS?
This is a matter that was discussed with the Chief Executive and other officers from GJBS, and it was decided that they put together a proposal that they could put together a dedicated team for schools, and it was decided that they should be engaged to provide that service.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister explain how this policy is now different to the one before, where GJBS staff were called into schools to carry out minor works maintenance projects?
Mr. Speaker, again, I am being asked to look into the past and look at the situation before we came into office. In this particular case, I happen to know how the position is different. All schools have, in the past, had access clearly to maintenance facilities. And as I understand it, that was traditionally provided by JBS. And that was on the basis that a requisition form was sent to the Department of Education, then on to JBS, and JBS, as of when they had somebody available to do that particular job, would send somebody to the schools. That's quite different to what we have at the moment, which is a dedicated team of JBS employees and a foreman dedicated exclusively to schools and who can be called upon. As I understand the position, previously JBS did act on requisitions, did provide, again as I understand, a good service to schools. They didn't have this dedicated facility. Whether it's going to be better or worse, time will tell, but what we certainly can say, it is slightly different, and it is a dedicated service for schools, which is what we said we would be putting in place, and we did so within a couple of months.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister say if these maintenance costs are to be paid from the different schools' individual maintenance budgets as per your new manifesto commitment, the new policy, or the costs are taken from the Department of Education's yearly maintenance budget, which was around £1.5 million as per the previous administration's maintenance spending?
Mr. Speaker, schools do not have their own individual budgets for maintenance. What we said in the manifesto is that that is something that we would bring into effect. That hasn't actually happened yet. What we've done is provide the dedicated maintenance team for schools, but that is being met out of central funds administered and controlled by the Department of Education themselves. I have discussed the issue of the specific dedicated budget for schools with head teachers. The view that has been taken for now is, let's see how this system operates, and although we are certainly committed to the extent that there is a need for individual budgets, it is something that we will put in place, but not immediately. I wanted to put in place this system immediately and see how it works, and then discuss further the maintenance requirements of the schools and how much they needed, having regard to how this system is working, paid for by central funds, controlled by the Department of Education. Then, having regard to that, see what else would be required by the schools by way of individual and dedicated budgets, which each headmaster would control. So that would be looked at following the implementation of the system and after the system has been running for a number of months.
That perhaps that would be a topic for a question at a further date. Finally, Mr. Speaker, can the Minister explain how the new maintenance team's policy will fit in with the school refurbishment programme? Will there be any link at all?
Speaker, it is a totally different policy and programme. As I explained in the original answer, this is maintenance in respect of works which are estimated at taking less than 5 days or 5 days or less. In other words, very, very minor works. There are, in addition, minor works plus refurbishment of schools. And what we have said we will do is put together a permanent refurbishment programme for schools that will be what will actually happen will be seen in the context of the new financial year, the allocation of a specific budget for that, but that will be coming on stream very soon, and it will be something very different to this, which is purely maintenance of very small works.
Question 282, the Honourable Mrs. Aya Mellul-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education tell us how many people applied for the position of Director of Education and when the successful applicant will be in post?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Education, Financial Services, Gaming, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, two people applied for this position. Interviews were held on Thursday, 8th of March 2012. I can confirm that the successful applicant was Mr. Joey Brito, who is in post as of 14th of March 2012. Mr. Brito was Senior Education Advisor at the Department of Education. He has been acting as Director of Education since 3rd January 2012, when the previous Director of Education commenced his new role on promotion to the post of Chief Secretary. I take this opportunity, Mr. Speaker, to welcome Mr. Brito to his new and important job and look forward to working with him. Certainly, I and the rest of the government look forward to working with him in relation to the government's education programme. I also want to take this opportunity at this stage of thanking the former Director of Education, Mr. Ernest Gomez, for his dedication over many years to the education in Gibraltar, and in particular for the excellent work he carried out over the more than 5 years that he spent as Director of Education.
On behalf of the opposition, certainly the opposition will associate themselves entirely with the words of the Honourable Minister and congratulate Mr. Brito, and also join with the Minister in thanking Mr. Ernesto Gomez for the work that he has done as Minister, as Director of Education.
Question 283, the Honourable Mrs. I. M. Alul-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Services state how much it will cost to run the Galpe ward on an annual basis, broken down by staffing costs, equipment and other costs?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Equality and Social Services.
Mr. Speaker, the cost of running Galpe ward for 2012-2013 will be £774,842, of which £603,306 is staffing, that is personal emoluments, wages, related allowances and social insurance. The recurrent cost of expenditure for the unit will be £171,482. The cost of equipment has been £136,445. This has been a one-off expenditure to equip the unit to its present state.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister confirm that I am right in assuming that a department has had to reissue the employment advert for registered nurses at levels 1 and 2 to man the Galpe ward because of a low level of people applying for the first advert that came out about 6 weeks ago?
No, Mr. Speaker, I am not aware, and perhaps if I had been given notice of that specific question, I would have been able to reply. I am not, as far as I'm aware, Mr. Speaker, there was an advert placed by the GHA, actually, not the care agency, and people applied to that advert, and in fact that question is asked by the Honourable Member later on, and I do have the details for that.
Oh no, I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker, actually it's asked as a written question.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister advise if all the 8 registered nurses and 18 care workers positions have been filled in order to run the Galpe ward properly?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. The date of appointment of the registered nurses is contained in the written answer, in the answer to the written question.
Question 284, the Honourable Mrs. I. M. Alul-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Services explain what the government's long-term plan of, I quote, a made-to-measure facility for the elderly, unquote, is, as outlined in their manifesto on their health page, under additional wards at St. Bernard's and facilities for the elderly?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Equality and Social Services.
Mr. Speaker, our manifesto commitment of a short-term policy of adding beds at St. Bernard's and having a made-to-measure facility for the elderly has already been met. This was achieved on the 26th of February 2012 by the opening of Galpe ward for 18 long-stay elderly patients and thereby releasing this number of acute beds in hospital. We will, of course, strive to provide further made-to-measure facilities for the elderly and will do so once the feasibility study as to the need is complete. The care agency and the Gibraltar Health Authority will work in close collaboration to achieve the same.
Mr. Speaker, for the sake of clarification, can the Minister explain if this is the same after the review will be conducted, high quality, I quote, high quality cost efficient nursing homes, which is also stated in the same paragraph on that page 30 of the manifesto.
Mr. Speaker, as I have said on previous occasions in this Parliament, the starting point will be to identify the need, and that is what we're doing now. Once we are able to identify the need, then we will move on to step two in terms of any as to the need for residential care, domiciliary care, and any other care for the elderly. We are not yet at that stage because the feasibility study is not yet complete.
I'm grateful for that, Minister, but it's just for the sake of clarification, because it has been brought up by several people while reading this paragraph in the manifesto under additional wards at St. Bernard's and facility for the elderly, because there's a mention of, as you rightly said, our short-term policy will be to add beds at St. Bernard's. We will also provide a made-to-measure facility for the elderly, which you have clarified is the Galper ward. But then it goes on to say it is time to provide high-quality, cost-efficient nursing homes in Gibraltar. And we would seek clarification if that means a home in addition to the new Alzheimer and Dementia Hospital that's being built. And it goes on to say we will do so to complement Mount Alverney and the new geriatric care wards, which I'm assuming is the Galper and Cochrane wards, and Alzheimer centres we will provide. Now, again, there has been question as to what these Alzheimer's centres are. Is this, again, the daycare centre that was already planned up at the Royal Naval Hospital site, or is this a new... So that paragraph is a little confusing, and members of the public are not sure how much more the government will be providing for Alzheimer's and elderly care.
Mr. Speaker, for clarification, no day centre at the RNH unit was planned. What was planned was a very little unit, which is not, by any stretch of the imagination, the type of day centre that would be suitable for the need of Alzheimer and dementia patients. Mr. Speaker, to clarify once again, before I can answer that question properly, I need to wait for the outcome of the feasibility study.
Mr. Speaker, the manifesto seems to be quite clear of what the government is pledging. Is the Minister suggesting that you may be reneging on what is stated in the manifesto?
Mr. Speaker, I am certainly not reneging on what is written in the manifesto. However, Mr. Speaker, as to the number of facilities or the type of facilities that we build will depend on the need for each individual facility, Mr. Speaker. And I will not know the exact need until the feasibility study is complete. What this government will do, Mr. Speaker, is assess the need and address the need, not the other way around, Mr. Speaker, because then we find ourselves with a situation that we have found ourselves at the dementia unit at the RNH, which will be that we may have to incur expense in having the layout of the premises fit for purpose. What we will do first is identify the need and we will work from there, Mr. Speaker.
Yes, expects that the Honourable Minister, having been a minister now for over 100 days, doesn't even know what extra expense there will be. She keeps on talking about all these works that need to be done to the dementia unit, and then when one asks a very simple question about, well, what's the extra cost, she doesn't even know that. But will the Honourable the Minister confirm, and I agree with her, that one analyses first need, and then one goes on to effectively meeting those needs. But wasn't that equation and that assessment and that analysis done when you clearly made manifesto commitments that you did, which are clearly making pledges in relation to facilities that you are promising to members of the public? Therefore, you either made those pledges without having done analysis of the deal, or you must have done so. Now, what is it?
Mr. Speaker, as we were not in government
more than 100 days ago, we couldn't have undertaken an in-depth analysis as to the needs for the elderly because we did not have access to the information that was required. Now that we are able to access that information, that feasibility study is being undertaken. Insofar as the costs of the RNH unit, what I said this morning, Mr. Speaker, was that of course there will be costs incurred in any changes, but I don't know the exact level of those costs because I don't know the exact level of the changes that will be made. And of course, Mr. Speaker, no architect and no engineer and no builder will make alterations free of charge. In fact, what I did say was that I have been asking for information on the costs given following on from the four changes that have already been requested to the plans at the RNH dementia unit by the previous government. And I still don't have that, Mr. Speaker, so I cannot give any further details.
Mr. Speaker, this side of the House was under the impression that the manifesto had been costed.
Speaker, not only has it been costed, I'm very happy to say it's been very accurately costed from the information that's coming across to us from the civil servants who are now looking at some of the commitments and what we can expect to see in respect of the tenders for construction of some of the projects that are in the manifesto. But that is not to say, Mr. Speaker, that in respect of some aspects of the manifesto, the Honourable Lady is going to be unable to give members opposite a figure of what the cost will be in undertaking certain works, some of which may only have arisen as a result of her own investigations having arrived in the department. It couldn't be otherwise, Mr. Speaker.
Question two.
Well, no, the Honourable Deputy Minister, but perhaps the Chief Minister can help me with the question that I asked the Honourable Lady. The Honourable Lady quite rightly says that one has to do an analysis of needs and then see what one has to do in order to meet those needs. But perhaps because he was involved in the writing, or he wrote, or was the principal writer of the manifesto, did he, when the manifesto pledge was made of we will also provide made-to-measure facilities for the elderly, and then there's a number of other commitments, had he conducted that assessment of needs when he made those pledges in the manifesto? Because she's absolutely right. You make pledges based on needs. But now when we ask her about, well, what extra facilities are you doing, she now falls back on having to conduct an assessment, which would have thought would have been done before writing that manifesto.
Mr. Speaker, I had an opportunity of hearing the answer that the Honourable Ms. Sacramento gave whilst I was in the antechamber, and I thought that she answered absolutely perfectly and demonstrating a maturity beyond her years as Parliament. You see, Mr. Speaker, what the Honourable Gentleman needs to understand is that from opposition one is able to make certain assessments, and from government assessments take obviously a different shape when one has the information available to one, that the Honourable Members opposite, despite being in opposition, will themselves have at the time that they come to fight the next general election under whoever it is that may lead that party. Because as I've said, I'm going to adopt the Douglas Home guidelines to allow members of the principal parties of opposition access to senior civil servants so that they can make assessments with information available to the civil service when the time comes to write their manifesto in 4 years' time. Something which he will know his party did not do when they were in office until the 8th of December, despite my public request that should have been the case.
Well, thank you very much for that party political broadcast. But he hasn't, respect, he hasn't answered the question. And you may, every time we ask a question of the Honourable Lady, decide to refer to the fact that the Honourable Lady has only been a minister for a short period of time. And I accept that. One has to give new ministers a certain amount of latitude. But one must also accept that we are doing our job, and that it is within our job, certainly description, of asking questions about commitments that the party opposite made when they were in opposition. Now, can he answer once and for all, well, what facilities did he have in mind when they made the commitments in the manifesto. It's a very simple question.
Mr. Speaker, I'm delighted to get up and refer the Honourable Gentleman to date to the short period of time that the Honourable Lady has been a minister, but I fully expect that she will be a minister for much longer than he has been a minister, and therefore the time will come when I have to refer to the fact that she has much more ministerial experience than he. But anyway, I'm delighted for them to come to this House to do their job, to ask us questions, but when it comes to issues of policy and how it is that we're going to implement parts of our manifesto and what it is that we had in mind when we were in opposition, I'll A, remind him of the debates we've had about me not having to tell him what it is that I have in mind, not having to be answerable for what we did in opposition, and C, remind him that he will very soon be seeing statements setting out different parts of our manifesto which are being implemented, and when we come to the point of making a decision to make the announcements of what we had in mind, he will read it in the press.
Speaker, if I may...
He obviously doesn't have a clue what he had in mind when he wrote the manifesto.
No, Speaker, I have many clues of many things I have in mind when I did many things, including when I wrote the manifesto. Not sharing with him doesn't mean that my mind is empty, although that may be what happens to him when he doesn't want to say much more than he has said to the microphone.
The Honourable Minister for Health.
Mr. Speaker, if I may come back to the question of assessing the need for the elderly, I think it is perfectly logical, as my Honourable friend Mr. Fita has pointed out, that when coming into government, a new government has to assess what the needs are. What is not logical or even acceptable is that the former government, who had the information at the time, did not assess the needs, because they have left us with a problem with the elderly. A problem to do with housing, a problem to do with domiciliary care, a problem with the institutionalization of the elderly, with our hospitals full of elderly people, not allowing acute medicine to take place. We have already started and taken immediate steps to relieve that. I think the shame is that the past government had not carried out that assessment, had given a false impression that there was a mental unit and a dementia unit that had already been properly designed, but they had not. And that is a point that we must miss, and that is a point that we are going to put right.
Well, thank you very much for that, but doesn't the Honourable Gentleman agree with me that building 86 flats at Bishop Ganesh, 145 flats for the elderly at Albert Rees, when in fact in the late 1990s only a third of Magdalena had in fact been open, whereas now that has triplicated in capacity? Would you not agree,
Mr. Speaker, on the
that
point,
that is
order,
not,
on the point of order, Mr. Speaker? This morning when I was listening to a less than edifying spectacle in this House, one of the rulings that you made was that we shouldn't be referring to things which were decades old. And if the Honourable Gentleman wants to get up and talk about the record of what he called this morning my government, namely his government, the one that ended on the 8th of December, that's a matter entirely for him. But I thought that after your ruling, he shouldn't be referring to things older than that.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I am actually asking a question arising out of a statement that the Honourable Gentleman has made about the record of the GSD in government. Now, what's good for the goose is also good for the gander. And look, I don't know, he says that he was listening to it on the radio. Well, the only unedifying spectacle was the fact that the former leader of the opposition challenged me to go to the anteroom to have a fisticuff with me.
Well,
that's the only unedifying
spectacle. Order. Now, I think we're going back into recent history. We're back in recent history. The matter was dealt with this morning. I don't think we need to go back into that. The Honourable Daniel Fitton is right. Having regard to the fact that the Honourable Minister for Health did refer to the state of affairs left by the previous administration, that can form the basis. But again, aimed at eliciting information or urging a course of action, not for defending previous government's policies.
If I might just clarify, sir. I'm not saying he can't refer to what his government, he called it this morning, my government. He talked of the GSD government that ended on the 8th of December as my government. Yeah, of course he can talk about that, but he was going back to 1993 and Mount
Alenia, etc. Exactly. I rule that in the context of the remarks made by the Honourable Minister, which was on the previous state of affairs left by the previous administration, that can form the basis of a question.
I wouldn't have asked the question had he not made the statement, but Mr. Speaker, I've already made the point, I think, that I want to make.
Then we can move on.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to make a final point on that statement regarding the state of affairs of the elderly on the 9th of December, being that this government inherited a waiting list for Montalvernia that exceeded 500 people, a waiting list of people on domiciliary care that exceeded 400 people, over 80 elderly people in surgical beds in the GHA, which resulted in over 100 operations being cancelled a year, Mr. Speaker. If we're going to talk about the state of affairs, Mr. Speaker, those are the facts on the 9th of December.
I would like to add, Mr. Speaker, the fact that we have had to assess numerous flats in Albert Rees' house because they were not suitable for the elderly.
But I must allow a question on this side. If there's a question, then we shall move on to the next question.
Question 285, the Honourable J.J. Netto.
Speaker, can the Minister for Social Services say if any government property or properties has been or is in the process of being prepared and refurbished for the purpose of having a secure unit in the short term prior to having a substantial property in the long term for children with severe challenging behaviour?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Equality and Social Services.
Mr. Speaker, options are being considered with regard to identifying an appropriate property to be used as a secure unit in the short term prior to establishing a property in the long term for children who display severe challenging behaviour which would require a secure unit.
If I understood the Honourable Lady correctly, she seems to be saying that a property is being identified for the purpose in the short term to provide a secure unit. I understood from the question from the last month that some flats are already being identified and that some works were in the process of being carried through in order to refurb those flats. Hence the reason why this has triggered my question today. So let me see if we can get this right. Do we have some flats in the short term in the private sector, in government housing stock, being refurbished as a short term measure for the purpose of a secure unit, as a short term? Is that the case?
Mr. Speaker, I said that flats have been identified, not that they have been refurbished. We are looking at identifying flats, or not flats, premises for it to be refurbished for the long term. Any short term flats are being identified but not necessarily require refurbishment. And that is what I believe I said in the last occasion and the occasion before.
Mr. Speaker, Hanser will say whether it was properties or flat, but anyway, that's a minor point which I don't want to dwell on. Can the Honourable Lady say whether they will be in a position within perhaps the next 3 months of knowing whether there is some properties which can be used, notwithstanding the fact that some refurbishment may have to take place and thereby use these properties as a short-term basis for placing some looked-after children with severe challenging behaviour?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. In fact, probably earlier, but certainly within 3 months.
Could we also ask the Honourable Lady, in terms of preparing for a situation where hopefully there will be a property in 3 months notwithstanding any refurbishment works, whether some consideration has been given by perhaps the senior management in this case of the care agency as to what the needs or the package that would have to be put together, the package that would need to be put together in order to deal with the necessities and the circumstances of these looked-after children with severe challenging behaviour.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that is something that we've already looked at. Predominantly, the most urgent thing in that respect is training, and DCRT training has already commenced. I explained that in the first meeting of this House, Mr. Speaker. I'm sure that the Honourable Member may recall, because I was asked questions specifically on that training.
by all means, of course, training is a most important necessity in the equation. But given that we are considering looked after children with severe challenge behavior, which presumably, in addition to having severe challenge behavior, may have emotional problems, social problems, is the care agency giving thought that these particular children may need perhaps a ratio of carers much bigger than the other one? And if so, have they considered, you know, the number of carers notwithstanding the training and the level of training that may have been obtained so far for this purpose?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and complement is actually being reviewed specifically for this purpose.
Could I also ask what specialist provision will be provided for this particular looked after children as a package?
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, I don't really understand the question, but I think that the answer is, Mr. Speaker, that the whole looked after, the whole secure accommodation arrangements are being reviewed, both in terms of the accommodation itself, the legislation that is required, and anything else that may be relevant to be able for Gibraltar to be able to provide secure accommodation.
I wasn't referring, Mr. Speaker, in relation to any possible amendment to the Children's Act for the purpose of having a secure unit, which, because obviously I understand that that would be a necessity. What I meant by a provision, specialist provision or care provision, given the nature of these particular children, whether, you know, a program would be put in place in terms of having educational psychologies, in terms of anger management, a whole range of different facilities that would be targeted for these particular children. That's what I meant by specialist care provisions, as opposed to the training, as opposed to the changes of legislation. Could the Honourable Member please expand on that area?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, because all those things that the Honourable Member has just mentioned are already provided for in any event, and it would be a question of enhancing those and making those facilities available to the secure accommodation.
I understand that obviously those services have already been there because they developed as I was there. But given the fact that we are talking about removing some of these children, I am assuming some of these children are in 20 of you right now, and hopefully they will be moving on to a property out there, there will be perhaps a question of resources that need to be thought through. Because if you have, for instance, one support of an educational psychologist attending there, or some particular psychologist attending to the other premises, they may not be able to duplicate that in a different area. I mean, one of the reasons, or one of the logical reasons behind Tangier Views was that the facilities would be available in one particular place. But by having different facilities, which I'm, as I expressed before, I'm not against the idea. In fact, I see it as a positive move, actually. Will that mean that there be extra resources over and above to the ones that already exist?
Mr. Speaker, as I have said ad nauseum already in reply to this question, the whole situation is under review. So if resources need to be provided, then resources will be provided.
Back to the Honourable Lady, I mean, the whole question may be a review, but what I'm trying to ask the Honourable Lady, which I think is a fair, sensible and reasonable question, is whether she thinks, regardless of what the review would say, whether extra resources will be needed as a result of this.
She did ask to prejudge the review. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member is asking specifically for that, for a prejudging of the review, also asking for an opinion by the Honourable Lady. The matter is currently being investigated. It's not appropriate for you to ask for an opinion from government. Minister's government is currently looking into the matter, the whole question of resources. And as soon as we are able to identify what is needed, then that will be announced.
Yeah, fair enough on in relation to that. But can I also ask in a slightly different supplementary question, are we still talking about, I think it was the figure that you provided in a different session, of 5 to 5 looked after children, are we still talking about that number, or has the number decreased or increased, which is something that is likely to happen in areas of this issue?
Mr. Speaker, I don't think that we've ever said that any secure accommodation would provide for 5 or 4. We've never said the number. That was a reply to a specific question of how many children are at present in care who manifest this severely challenging behaviour. The unit obviously would have to cater for a certain minimum looked after children. But again, Mr. Speaker, that is part of the review, because we would have to, the review would establish the pattern of the need, because we cannot just go by the figures that we have given the children in care right now. We would have to see the pattern and see whether that pattern shows a consistent figure in the past, so that we are able to cater for enough children in the future.
Question 286, the Honourable J.J. Jetto.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Service state if there have been any recordable acts of violence in any of the care agency residential homes, since this question was asked in question number 169 of 2012 to date? And if so, could the Minister provide a breakdown showing the dates of the incidents or incidents, whether the incidents or incidents were between children or between children and staff, and whether as a result of the incident medical attention was required either at the home or in the hospital, and for what purpose?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Equality and Social Services.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, there has been one incident of recordable acts of violence in care agency residential homes since this question was asked in question number 169 of 2012. On the 2nd of March 2012, there was one incident between a child and a member of staff. No medical attention was required for the incident.
Question 287, the Honourable J.J. Detton.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Services say if there have been any looked after children in the care of the care agency in any of their residential homes who have been absconding since the 9th of December 2011, and if so, could the information be provided on a monthly basis and stating how long the absconding lasted, whether any of them may have been engaged in acts of violence against other looked after children or staff members?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Equality and Social Services.
Mr. Speaker, there have been a total of 23 incidents of children absconding since the 9th of December 2011, 16 of which involved the same child. I am now handing out a table with the dates of the absconding, the time the absconding lasted, and whether any of them have been engaged in acts of violence against other looked after children or staff members.
Whilst the information is coming through, perhaps, I don't know whether it will be contained in the information coming, but can the Honourable Member say whether all these incidents of absconding has been within Gibraltar, or perhaps some of these looked after children have even absconded and gone into Spain?
Mr. Speaker, I cannot answer that question for certain, but I can say that I have not been advised that anyone has absconded across the border. I cannot confirm that for certain, but certainly I am usually advised when a child absconds, and I'm usually given the background, and I have not been informed that anyone has been absconding in Spain.
Okay, Speaker, we can move on to the next one.
Question 288, the Honourable J.J. Netto.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Service say what is the total number of elderly persons receiving domiciliary care as at the end of February 2012?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Equality and Social Services.
Mr. Speaker, the number of elderly persons receiving domiciliary care as at the end of February 2012 is 88.
Sorry, I missed the... How many?
88.
Mr. Speaker, obviously the figure of 88, which the Honourable Lady has just given us, is a figure which is less than the figure than we left off, which was 91 persons receiving, yes, Mr. Speaker. The figure of people receiving domiciliary care as provided by the senior management of the care agency to me was 91. Now, leaving that aside, what I would like to ask the other lady, which is, I think, much more important than that, is that given that we have 88 persons receiving domiciliary care, and given that last month, the Honourable Lady, I think it was last month, she was saying in one of her answers to one of my questions that there are elderly people in the community who, I think, were not receiving any help either from the family or from the care agency. Shall I give way to the Honourable Lady and clarify that before I proceed?
I don't have the answer to that question before me, but as I recall, there were no people in the community, according to our records, receiving no domiciliary care or no help from their family. I am happy to perhaps to go back and check that, but as I recall the table, there were people who were either assisted by way of domiciliary care, assisted by way of help from their family, or by both, not by neither.
Well, perhaps... We would have to look at Hansen, but I do think to recall that there were a group of people that they were not receiving any help either from the extended family or from the care agency. And given that there has been no increase, perhaps decrease, as I would think, in the number of help of people receiving domiciliary care, would it not be the case, perhaps, Mr. Speaker, that the government, obviously, she doesn't hold the financial purse strings, but if the Honourable Lady, as she said just a while ago, there are so many people waiting for domiciliary care, right, would she not, having a collegiate government as they have, not inform one of his colleagues who's got the purse strings, perhaps to ask for a bit of more money in order to allow more people to have domiciliary care? Because at the end of the day, if there is no spare capacity to attend the needs of these people, either because Mount Alvernia is full, right, perhaps help could be given in the community in order to try and give some domiciliary care. So can they undertake that?
Mr. Speaker, if she does, she'll be pushing at an open door.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Chief Minister, repeat that.
If she does, Mr. Speaker, she'll be pushing at an open door.
And, Mr. Speaker, in response to the questions, first of all, I want to clarify that I'm not aware when senior management informed the Honourable Member as to the number of people who were receiving domiciliary care previously. But certainly my information for the purpose of this question is that before the 9th of December 2011, the number of people receiving domiciliary care was 79. That is less than the number of people receiving domiciliary care today. Obviously, Mr. Speaker, I have to rely on the information that is provided to me by my senior management, but certainly that is the information that I have received. But what is significant to note, Mr. Speaker, is that not only has this new government increased the number of people who are now receiving domiciliary care in the last 100 days, but we have also increased the number of hours that are afforded to the elderly following individual assessment of their needs. In addition, Mr. Speaker, elderly people already receiving domiciliary care hours in the community, of which the maximum under the previous administration was only 2 hours a day, have also had their hours reviewed and increased if necessary, following individual assessments of their needs. Now, to put this into context, Mr. Speaker, the total number of recipients of domiciliary care prior to the 9th of December 2011 was 79. they were receiving a total of 420.5 hours per week. From the end of February to date, there are now 88 recipients receiving domiciliary care, and they are receiving a total number of 530.5 hours a week. Thus, this is an increase of 110 hours per week, a 26.2% increase to what the previous government was affording.
Well, Mr. Speaker, in relation to that particular point, let me tell the Honourable Lady that the same senior management that's giving her the figures gave me the figures that there were 91 persons receiving domiciliary care, but that's not the issue here for debate. Will the Honourable Lady, therefore not provide me a breakdown of the number of people who are now getting more hours than the 2 hours that was previously the case?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I fail to see the relevance of that question. I don't have the exact figures of who is receiving more hours and who is receiving domiciliary care that they weren't receiving before. I don't have that specific breakdown, Mr. Speaker. Well, therefore, I'm unable to provide it.
Yeah, the Honourable Lady may not be in a position to provide that specific information, but relevance it has because of the point made by the Honourable Lady. No, the answer was she has all the information at hand, but I rule that it is relevant because she did mention the amount of hours.
Therefore, I presume she hasn't got the information there available in front of her in as much as to how many people now are getting more than 2 hours domiciliary care. Does she have the information there available? No, you haven't. Therefore, if I do write to her, will she provide me with that information, Mr. Speaker?
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Speaker. I understood the question as the Honourable Member wanting to know who the people were. Not the number of people. That's why I question the relevance. Certainly, in terms of the figures, if the Honourable Member were to write to me, yes, I'm happy to give him a breakdown.
Mr. Speaker, just for sake of clarification, can the Honourable Member opposite just clarify if it has increased from 79 to 88 patients receiving domiciliary care with an extra 120 hours per week on average? What has been done in order to enhance the service? Have more staff been employed?
Mr. Speaker, it is a combination of more people receiving domiciliary care and people who were previously receiving domiciliary care receiving more hours of domiciliary care. Perhaps I can inform the Honourable Member opposite that domiciliary care is subcontracted to a company in the private sector, and these hours are then subcontracted. There is a contract with a company in the private sector. These hours are subcontracted to them.
In the context of what she just said, whether it is just the continuation of one contractor providing that particular service or there are more than one?
At present, Mr. Speaker, as I'm sure the Honourable Member recalls, government is tied into a contract with a particular provider in the private sector, and it is that contract under which we are working.
Who knows until when the contract lapses?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I do.
Perhaps volunteer without me having to stand up every 5 seconds as to when?
Speaker, the contract that the Honourable Member entered into with his company expires in 2013.
The Honourable David Messina.
Yes. Does the increase in hours result in extra costs to the government?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Speaker. They have to be paid for.
Yes. On this point. And can she, does she have the information available to her now as to what that cost amounts to?
Well, the hourly rate remains the same, so the number of hours will have to be multiplied by the cost of the service. And I think the price under the contract is, I think it's £12.40-something. It's just over £12.
Questions to 6.9.
Question 289, the Honourable J.J. Netto.
Speaker, can the Minister for Social Service state on how many occasions has the Care Agency Board met since the 9th of December 2011?
Answer, the Honourable the Minister for Equality and Social Services.
Mr. Speaker, there have been no Care Agency Board meetings since the 9th of December. One is being arranged for the 28th of March 2012.
Mr. Speaker, is the Honourable Lady aware that the Care Agency Act, Clause 5.2, states the agency shall meet at least once in every 3 months?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and I am sure that the Honourable Member was also aware of that provision when the last meeting of the Care Agency Board was on the 11th of April 2011, Mr. Speaker. There was no meeting in September 2011 nor in December 2011, Mr. Speaker.
I certainly don't recall that. I do recall the fact that there was one particular meeting which I couldn't attend to, but obviously I designated the chief executive of the Care Agency to take the meeting for my purposes. I don't know whether she's referring to that particular meeting or not.
No, Mr. Speaker. The meeting that the Honourable Member is referring to, the one that was convened but he did not attend as chair, was that of April 2011. So in effect, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member did not attend the meeting of the Care Agency Board since the 26th of January 2011.
Mr. Speaker, can I ask the Honourable Lady whether she intends to make the meetings of the Board public, as some of her colleagues have stated?
Mr. Speaker, that would be a matter for the Board.
Does the Honourable Lady not agree with me that, and I don't know what the position was in the times of my government, but a little like Cuba in a sea of does she not agree with me that to have not done something not in accordance with the Children's Act when we were in government doesn't justify the continuation of the practice now that they are in government?
Mr. Speaker, the Children's Act does not dictate the meetings of the Care Agency Board.
The relevant statute, Mr. Speaker. The lady knows exactly what I'm referring to. She wants to give an answer. She doesn't want to give the answer. She doesn't have to. The question is a serious question. She has my friend Mr. Netto has asked her whether there's been any meeting. She has said no. My friend Mr. Netto has then said, "Well, are you aware of the fact that the statutory obligation is 3 months?" And then she has said yes. And when you were the minister, there weren't any meetings since April. Now, I think it's a serious state of affairs if we're all going to be accepted that we're not going to be complying with our statutory obligations because of what was past practice. Now, I ask her again, does she not agree with me that it's not an excuse not to comply with your statutory obligations simply because there's been that there's been non-compliance by a previous administration?
Mr. Speaker, can I please remind the Honourable Member of my original answer, which said that one is being arranged for the 28th of March 2012. That is within the first quarter of this government, Mr. Speaker, in compliance with the statute. The fact that the previous administration did not comply with its obligations of the statute is a matter for them, Mr. Speaker, not a matter for this government. This government is complying with its statutory obligations. And, of course, I agree with the Honourable Member that it is important to comply with statutory obligations.
Well, Mr. Speaker, unless my maths has really gone awry, and I know that it's quite late on a Friday afternoon, if it's 3 months, it should have been done by the 9th of March, not by the 28th of March.
Mr. Speaker, yes, there isn't any statutory obligation to have a meeting within 3 months of a new government coming in. Every 3 months usually means every quarter of the year, and that is precisely what my government is doing. If the honourable member was the Minister for Justice and he refers to it as my government, I am the Minister for Justice and other things, and therefore I believe I have the privilege of calling this my government as well. And in those circumstances, we are complying with the statutory obligations. The honourable member should be asking his colleague why it was that in the last quarter of last year, before they retired from office, before they were sacked from office by Gibraltar, why they didn't comply with the legislation.
Don't you see, the honourable gentleman is wrong, I'm afraid, and he is wrong. And there is a serious point here, and we will accept whatever criticism is levelled, justifiable criticism is levelled our way. The statute actually provides, according to my friend Mr. Lindo, that it should be held every 3 months. Now, if that is the position, and the last one was in April, then of course there was an obligation to hold one as quickly as possible into your term of office, not on the 28th. That's not what the statute says.
Mr. Speaker, that is his interpretation of the statute, which is wrong, because the statute does not say as quickly as possible as you come into office. Had we had a meeting on the 9th of December, there would still have been a default of the legislation, because the act says every 3 months. The previous meeting was in April of 2011. Even if we had had one on the first day in office, that would still have been in default. What we have done is decided that there should be, or rather the care agency has decided, is that there should be a meeting every quarter. And the first quarter's meeting is happening this month, which is within the first 3 months of this year. That is what's happening.
Can I ask one more supplementary question to the Honourable Lady? The Honourable Lady, when I ask her whether she's considering the fact of making the meetings of the board public, she said that will be a matter for the board. Will she therefore take that particular question to the board to the next meeting in order to decide whether they will be making the meeting public or not?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, as is the policy of this government and the policy of transparency, which we say did not hitherto exist, not before the 9th of December. This is a matter that I'm happy to take to the board. However, Mr. Speaker, it is a decision that needs to be taken by the board. It is not a decision that I can take.
Mr. Speaker, can I add to that? The Honourable Member will be aware that clearly the board will be dealing with sensitive issues, issues relating to care proceedings, issues relating to children, and there will be sensitive issues that perhaps ought not to be made public. So in the consideration of that, those matters will have to be taken into account, and we don't want to make the board unworkable, but there are sensitive issues that this particular board will have to deal with, which may make the position different to other boards. But we take on board what the Honourable Member has said, and as the Honourable Lady has indicated, the matter will be taken to the board for a decision.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I do take that into account in the similar way as it happens with the Health Authority Board.
This one is generally dealing with children and more sensitivities.
No, we certainly agree that must be the position, and that must be right. There are possibly ways of dealing with it by redacting names, by redacting references to circumstances, but certainly on this side of the House, if the government were to decide not to publish those minutes, we would not be criticising the government for not doing so.
Mr. Speaker, I'm certainly grateful for that. Let me just point out also, it's not just a question of public, of redacting names in published documents. If the meetings are in public, as has been suggested, then the issue of redactions doesn't apply. The information becomes public. So those are sensitivities, and I acknowledge that the Honourable Member has agreed with those sensitivities.
Question 304, the Honourable D.J. Bosino.
Can the Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services advise whether the government has identified other areas to make available for free overnight parking other than those provided at the Europort Avenue and Bayside Road car parks?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the government is presently looking into all park areas of Gibraltar which are presently being used during the day for a specific purpose with a view of the possibility of allowing their use by the general public overnight, as was the case with Europort Avenue and Bayside Road car parks. These areas in question were reserved for the specific use of school teachers. The government will make this information public if and when areas are found to be suitable.
Presumably, at this stage, the answer from the Minister is no.
Mr. Speaker, the answer is that we are actually looking into other areas in Gibraltar. In fact, there are three areas that we're specifically looking into, but until we're not sure that they can be used for that purpose, we prefer not to make this information public.
I have received the reason why I asked this question, Mr. Speaker, is because I have received representations in relation to a specific area in Gibraltar, and there's an interest that a certain area location be made available using a similar regime. Nobody wants to consult with you. Using a similar regime, which has been implemented in relation to the car parks, which have already been freely made available or released to the general public during certain hours. This is why I asked the question.
Mr. Speaker, we would be actually very grateful if you do have that information and refer it to us so that we actually take that that area into account. Part of the public consultation exercise, it's what it is, public consultation, and if members across the board have any suggestions, by all means, we're happy to take them on board.
Now, in relation to the public consultation exercise, once again, I think I've made this point in previous sessions of this House to the Honourable Minister. Can you confirm that it is the public consultation exercise which is being carried out by the government in relation to the major review of traffic?
That is correct. That's the review of traffic plan, yes.
And given that we are now on the 16th of March, can the Minister give me an indication as to when he envisages that he will be able to reach a final decision in relation to the various locations?
I believe there's a question further on that actually asks about the traffic plan and what stage we're at the moment.
Question 305, the Honourable D.J. Bosino.
Can the Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services provide the House with details of the arrangements the government has entered into with car exporting businesses in connection with the offer of car parking facilities at the Devil's Tower Road multi-storey car park?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the government has reached an agreement with Gibraltar-based motor car exporters to provide them with space in which to park their vehicles. This is in line with the policy of the new government to generate revenue from assets which were not producing income before. Following a study carried out, it was confirmed that the car park at Devil's Tower Road was being underutilised, and it was also confirmed that there was no waiting list for residents of the area wanting to park their cars there. The decision was taken to offer space in the said car park to the Bastoni group of companies in which to park vehicles destined for export. This should be seen in the context of both the need to generate income for the government and also of the delay to the planned West Beach reclamation,
progressed under the previous GST administration, in which the Barcelona Group were earmarked a section where the export business could be consolidated, including an area where the company could park their export vehicles. The consequences of the considerable delay in the provision of this parking base at Western Beach is an important factor that the GSP Liberal administration has taken into account throughout the discussions with the company. The Barcelona Group will make a payment of £150,000 per year for the car parking arrangements. This directly releases land in other parts of Gibraltar, which will now be available to the government for development or for other purposes. At the same time, the AM Caputo Group contacted the government in view of also looking for space to park their export vehicles. As a result of the Barcelona Group reducing the space they occupied in Regal House car park, it was agreed that the AM Caputo Group would occupy an area of this car park in Regal House for their own export parking requirements. They would pay the government £70,000 per annum in return for this parking facility. It is important that the government provides assistance to companies which are bringing in new business and employing in Gibraltar. It is also particularly important that Gibraltar Car Parks Limited, which is a huge loss-making operation set up by the previous administration, receives some very much needed income from previously empty car parking space. The deal is therefore good for the taxpayer and good for Gibraltar.
Much of what the Minister said was previously set out in a press statement, in the government press statement of 154 2012. Now, what I was getting at or driving at in asking this question is more particulars of what specific arrangements have been entered into with the Barcelona Group. Are there, is it a lease arrangement? Is it a license arrangement? For how long is it expected that the Barcelona Group will be occupying the area at the multi-storey car park, things of that nature?
Mr. Speaker, this is a license arrangement and it's on a monthly basis.
I mean, I'm not sure how much space is now left in the Devil's Tower Road multi-storey car park. But what is the government's intention in relation to the usage of that car park in the future? Will it still be used as a park and ride, which was my government's intention when it built that construction, or does it have? Does the minister envisage that it will be used for different purposes now?
Well, the car park in question was never used as a park and ride facility. It was never up and running. That was intention, but it was never used came to fruition. As I said, as part of the review, we're actually looking at where we progress. And one of our manifesto commitments was actually to look at the possibility of building park and ride facilities closer to the point of entry to avoid actually having cars actually coming into Gibraltar. With the problematic Sunday roundabout, is trying to keep them closer to the frontier area.
So was the GST party's intention to use it as a park and ride facility? That's why it was built. There's no reason for it. Now, in terms of progression, can the minister, I don't think he's answered the question, can he identify whether building is now going to be used as a park and ride, or were they going to abandon that the former government's policy in relation to that, in relation to the multi-storey car park?
It is actually too early to actually know for us to be sure what the final purpose of the car park will be. As again, we're reviewing the whole traffic parking situation in Gibraltar, especially the district parking schemes, and based on that, then we will see whether this will be used as a park and ride or not. We still have no concrete plans at the moment.
Again, in terms of time, does he know when he will have those concrete plans available?
The consultation process and obviously the review will take a considerable amount of time. Again, I'm not sure how long this will take. So until all that process is finished, I won't be in a position to be able to tell you, ideas of timescale.
Respect. I think the Minister may not have answered accurately. The consultation, as I understand it from his replies in this House on previous occasions, is that the consultation process has in fact completed, and what he's now reviewing is the data. So maybe can he clarify the answer?
In fact, in my reply to your next question, I'll be clarifying all these points. It features in our next question.
Presumably the reason why the government has entered into license arrangements as opposed to lease arrangements with the Basodia Group is that it can be determined, the license arrangements can be determined on a monthly basis at the government's will.
Yes, obviously it gives us and them enough leeway to be able to continue or discontinue the arrangement, because if as part of the traffic plan, if we find that the car park needs to be used for another purpose, then obviously we can discontinue the arrangement and continue using for what we intend it's used to be.
In respect of the areas relinquished by Basnar and Kapoor Road, are you able to, is the Honourable Minister able to provide us with details of those areas?
Yes, the areas which have actually remained vacant is the ex-MOD trailer park and an area up by Bufadero. Yeah, but for the areas, the actual where the band is the parade area.
Mr. Speaker, presumably there is an element of leeway in this arrangement, obviously, because it is a monthly license. But one would also presume that if Macedonia in particular are relinquishing the use of the two areas specified by the Honourable Minister, that in the event that the government should decide that the multi-storey car park should be used for the purpose for which it was originally built, that Barcelona will have a new need for an area in which to store those vehicles which are now in the multi-storey car park. Has there been any discussion with Barcelona in respect of the potential for that difficulty in the future?
Yes, well, our immediate plans for the car park, as I said, because of the review and the time it will take, we don't believe that we're going to have an immediate need to use that car park. So obviously our idea was to capitalise on the fact that we have a car park that's not been used much, generate some income from it. And obviously in time, hopefully not just in the future, the area, assigned for Barcelona, which is the Western Beach reclamation, will be hopefully up and running, ready for them to move into. That's the plan.
Therefore, Mr. Speaker, it is not a quantum leap to assume that the government has no imminent plans for the use of the ex-MOD trailer park or indeed that particular area of Bufadero.
The government at the moment is actually looking at the areas in question, and because land obviously is not something that we obviously have a lot of, there's quite a few ideas for the areas in question.
Question 306, the Honourable D.J. Bosino.
Can the Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services now provide details of the findings arising from the public consultation exercise the government has carried out in relation to the traffic plan?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the government has now completed the first stage of the public consultation process, although it must be noted that any feedback received at any point during the review, even after set public consultation period, will still be considered. It is the government's opinion that the process of consultation needs to be fluid in this respect. All the information collected to date has now been catalogued, and once the full consultation is completed, including feedback, suggestions and comments derived from a user and trip survey, the government will be in a better position to provide details of the findings.
This is some sort of technical jargon, I'm just completely missed it. What's the minister referring to by a user and what survey?
Well, as part of the consultation process, we will be actually surveying users as to what trips they regularly take. So it's a consultation exercise whereby people are actually surveying, you know, where you're going, you know, for what purpose have you got your mode of transport, you know, that sort of question. It's a user related, it's a user survey, transport user survey.
I see. So you're going to be carrying out some sort of questionnaire, which is going to be made available to the public at large. Yes. Is that what the minister is referring by the users?
That's right. To actually see whether we can actually ascertain why people, you know, choose to drive their own cars to work as opposed to getting public transport or their bicycles or whatever, and to see what their customs are. What you know, how many people travel in one vehicle? You know, why? You know, I mean, do they drive the kids to school even though it's just, you know, a 10-minute walk away? Really, just to see, you know, what people's behaviour are in terms of their transports.
Would he describe that as the second stage of the consultation process? The first stage presumably was the one that was announced in the press statement issued in January, which allowed a very small window of about 2 weeks, I think, up to the 30th of January, within which people, interested parties to the minister will recall the while the controversial issues which arose in the first session of this House, also very late on the Friday afternoon, in fact, I think it's almost Friday night, in relation to that, in relation to the use of that wording by the minister. So that would be the first stage. Now the second stage is this questionnaire, which is going to be issued by his department. Would the minister concur with me that that is a correct analysis of the consultation process?
Right. The actual public consultation exercise is broken down in different stages. Initially, it was a public consultation exercise, which is we launched a press release, and obviously people, anyone could just come in and participate, inclusive of whether they were, you know, part of tenants' associations, etc. So that's just a general feedback on the public. After that, now we, obviously apart from the user trip survey that we're going to be carrying out as well, we're also homing in now on more specific organisations, if you like. For example, we're homing in on tenants' associations, management companies. We'll be talking to the Chamber of Commerce, emergency services, and other, you know, entities, commercial entities that actually use or have a need to use our roads for their business. So we really want to, you know, this survey or this consultation exercise will cover, you know, as many, you know, across the board as possible to get, you know, true idea as to what people's requirements are and needs are, and before we finally make a decision as to where we are going.
At what stage will the minister, does the minister intend, or does he think he will be able to consult the entities he's just listed by way of example?
Right, as I said, at the moment we're almost through the different tenants associations. We've actually seen most of the different tenants associations around the board of the management committees. We still have a few more to meet with. Our next stage will be talking to us, people like the Chamber of Commerce. We've also the bus company, there's obviously bus drivers will be included, the taxi association, emergency services already, and also disability groups. We also want to get an idea as to what, you know, other people with different requirements are in need of.
So if I took a snapshot of the consultation exercise at the moment, you would be saying that it is in train. You're in train, you're actually carrying out the consultation at this present moment.
That's right. The consultation process is, you know, very wide and far. Obviously, it's not specific to a certain sector of the community. We want to get as wide a picture as possible to take most people's accounts into consideration. Obviously, not everyone's opinions will be able to take those into account. But we want to get at least as much feedback as possible before we actually, you know, launch what will be our traffic and parking and transport plan.
The Minister in the last session of the House said, and I quote, and this is really what informed the posing of the question in the terms that it was posed. He said, Mr. Speaker, the data is actually being collated by members of staff. This is the data collated as a result of, if I can presumably call it, the first stage of the consultation process. They are actually preparing a summary spreadsheet of all the findings, and once that is finished, which I hope they will be finishing shortly, that will be handed back to me, and then I will be in a position to be able to give more specific details of the outcome. Now, is the minister at this stage able to provide those specific details at this stage?
The sheer amount of comments and feedback that we're receiving would make it impossible for me to actually share all that with, and until obviously, what I am willing to share a few things, as I said, across the board, so you can understand what the comments are. Those comments are an immense amount of comments in all stages. But in the interim, a few salient comments, which, as I said, have arisen from the consultation exercise so far, which I'm happy to share with members across the floor. For example, one of the key problems faced by the general public is the lack of provision of visitor car parking space within the North District, especially for visitors who need to go and see family members, or even worse still, need to deliver food or even help elderly members of their family. So that is one of the biggest problems that we've something which has kept on coming back to us. I've got to drop my mum off at home. I can't stop the car anywhere. And if I do stop my car there, we can get their fine for it. So that's one of the biggest issues we've seen so far. Another comment, which has been popular comment, has been, in fact, the complaint of the lack of regard that's been to the pedestrian, especially along the west pavements in the vicinity of the Trafalgar interchange. Because the Trafalgar interchange, if you obviously think about what the Trafalgar interchange is, it might alleviate the flow of traffic, but in terms of pedestrian flow, anyone walking along the west pavement finds that there's not a suitable area to cross, and you see people crossing anywhere along the road. And there's been lots of complaints regarding that. There's actually no zebra crossing between Rag and Staff Gates all the way up to the Piccadilly Piccadilly Garden Bar. So these are such some of the comments that people will receive. I mean, there's loads of feedback. So as I said, this is all being collated now in spreadsheet format for us to actually analyse in due course.
The minister undertake to disclose the information once it is in digestible, if I can put it in those terms, format.
We won't undertake, but we will agree to do so.
I'm grateful. I'm grateful for that.
Mr. Speaker, I would hazard a guess that at least 48% of the users hold, receiving the questionnaire, living outside the city limits, will be rubbing their hands with glee at the prospect of having double the number of car parking spaces at what his government will hope will be the spectacular football parade park, for which I will congratulate the Minister for Environment if it ever comes to fruition. In due course, as I'm strolling through it. It's subject, of course, Mr. Speaker, to geotechnical surveys, which have not yet been carried out. Unless, of course, the geotechnical services come up. It doesn't really matter. I'm not going to digress any further than that from the point. However, I have been absorbing far too much of preambles in the last few sessions. I'm afraid it's rubbing off on me.
I hope not.
One question I would ask of the Minister is whether, despite the observations that may be represented to the government during the consultation process, whether the government itself has clear views as to what measures or as to a number or examples of measures that it will be taking to alleviate the historic problem of the school run, the first thing in the morning, and all those other perennial issues that the community has faced, despite the huge investment by my government during its time.
Of course, we have great ideas for what we want to do. Our success will be announced. Of course, and we will announce it in due course.
So the Minister is unable to provide us with any examples of the ideas that you're thinking about at this time?
That's great, not at the present.
Just one final supplementary. You may just confirm a point, which I think he dealt with in one of his initial replies. If I, using myself as an example, have or Joe Bloggs out there has an interest in making further representations and participate in the consultation process, which was open for that window 2 weeks in January 2012, and he wishes to make further representations, given the fluidity, using his word, of the process. Can that individual still make submissions to his department?
By all means, it's happening constantly. I mean, just because the consultation period as such ended, it doesn't mean I don't receive comments and feedbacks on a daily basis in the office, by email or even by my regular mail.
Yes, but can he assure this House, that in order to have finality to this process, can he assure this House that work is truly underway in relation to the production of the digestible information, for like the spreadsheet information, which he agreed to make available to me, which will show the results of, as I understand it, the first stage of that consultation process?
I think the Minister did say what the Honourable Member is asking. We ask for assurance and truly, I think, rather pushing it more than need be. As opposed to not truly.
I withdraw that if it suggests that he was in any way being mendacious previously. I'm not suggesting that.
I'm suggesting that the question need not be put.
Well, it's just that
pushing the same point.
I just don't understand that there has to come a point where there has to be finality in terms of receipt of representations from the general public. And in fact, the government was very clear in its first press statement when they said that would allow a period of, from issue of the press statement, which from memory I think was the 15th of January, to the 30th of January, within which representations would be received, welcomed, and received from the public as part of it, what is now being described as the first stage of that public consultation exercise. What one would expect is that after the 30th of January deadline, that would be closed, and his department would be carrying out the necessary administrative work, in order to produce the summaries, spreadsheets, which the government is at this stage not able to provide this House or me with. So I'm just slightly concerned that the government is still in receipt of the data, if you like, which will result in the spreadsheet information, given the fluidity which the Minister referred to earlier. So, and all I want is the Minister's assurance that there will be finality to this, and that at some stage in the not-too-distant future, which is what he said in the session on the 15th of February, he will be in a position to say, look, I've finished, my department has finished the spreadsheet information, the collation, and therefore the production of the spreadsheet information, and it is available.
It appears as if there's actually implicit criticism that, of civil servants that they are actually taking too long in doing this. I mean, this is something.
It's neither, certainly not explicit, neither was it intended to be implicit criticism of anybody. I'm just simply trying to address the issue that this cannot continue ad nauseum, and there has to be finality to this. And I just sense that given the fact that there was initially finality and now there's fluidity and collation of the spreadsheet information.
There will be finality on this issue, obviously, but obviously when we actually have finalized this, then we will, give you more information on it. But I mean, we can't be pushed to finalize this sooner. What we want to make sure, is that this public consultation exercise is what we intend to be, which is thorough, and takes the time that it needs before we actually take a final decision. We don't want to rush things or have to rush things just in order to be able to present, findings.
Mr. Speaker, on the recommendation of the Honourable Chief Minister, recommendation which I refuse to let pass by, in attempt to define soon, are you able to commit to a time frame within which you expect the process will be finalised and you will be able to publish the findings? Mr. Speaker, the word soon is a word which is to be found in the English dictionary that has a natural and ordinary meaning. I refer him to the definitions provided by the previous incumbent of the post of Chief Minister in the past 4 years. He'll find many exchanges in Hansard as to what that word means.
And for the avoidance of doubt, Mr. Speaker, is the Honourable the Chief Minister say that he intends to conduct business of Chief Minister in the same way as our leader did at the time in that. But no, Mr. Speaker, but I intend to continue speaking the same language, which is the one that the Honourable Gentleman has asked about. He's asked for the definition of the word soon. The definition of the word soon is in the dictionary. It's, in fact, a question he therefore cannot ask because there is a published definition. And there is, in the lexicon of his party, a definition, which I'm sure is the one that he believes is the correct one, was that he's saying that his party defined the word soon in the wrong way.
Mr. Speaker, struggling though the Honourable the Chief Minister may be at this time on a Friday afternoon to understand the context of the question that I asked. To clarify just a little bit further, Mr. Speaker, all I wanted to do was to try and define for the purposes of this exercise and in this House, in this particular context, what meaning we are going to give to the word soon, be it end of March, end of April, end of if you are unable to do so, Mr. Speaker, then you're unable to do so. Mr. Speaker, the word soon has a definition. The words end of March have a definition, end of April have a definition, etc. If it had been end of March or end of April, then that would have been the answer. The answer is soon, and the Honourable Gentleman can make up his mind for himself of what that will mean in effect in the context of what is happening here this afternoon.
Mr. Speaker, I have the benefit of being one of the newest faces in this House, and I am not prone to pushing the matter. I'm not prone to pushing the matter any further unnecessarily. It is obvious that the Honourable the Chief Minister does not want to commit his government to a specific time frame, but it would be far more helpful for him just to say so.
I believe your government does
exist. If the Honourable the Chief Minister doesn't want to commit his government to a different definition of the word sooner than that one which is published in the Oxford English Dictionary, which is the one I'm happy to adopt.
I think we're ready to move to the next question.
As a point of clarification, the word used was finished, but words used were finishing shortly. I don't know whether that changes matters.
Is that any sooner than soon?
The next question, 307, the Honourable S.M. Figueras.
Can the Minister for Technical Services confirm whether there are any audit systems in place in technical services with the purpose of identifying vandalism of and faults developing throughout the traffic network?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, Technical Services has a highways inspection system in place that involves scheduled inspections of our entire road network for any defects and faults. This includes not only roads, but also passageways, lanes, footways, as well as bridges, tunnels, and any other structures that could be of concern to users of our roads. There is no system as such exclusively for vandalism, but any issues arising from this are also picked up as part of the safety inspections.
I am grateful to the Honourable Minister. Is he satisfied that the current system of the highways, the highways inspection system, is appropriate and adequate?
At the moment, this system is actually what we have inherited at the time. I mean, I've actually been in consultation with the department. We might have to tweak it slightly, but for the moment in time, I am satisfied, reasonably satisfied that it can progress.
Question 308, the Honourable J.J. Netto.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health and Safety state how many inspections during February 2012 did the factory inspectors conduct, showing the industry group targeted, whether any possible contravention has been incurred to the Factories Act or any subsidiary legislation by any private company, a Gibraltar government workplace, or of the MOD, and whether legal advice has been sought?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, two inspections on private companies were carried out during the requested period and both were construction related. No major contraventions to the Factories Act or its subsidiary legislation were identified and no legal advice had or has been sought.
Question 309, the Honourable J.J. Netto.
Speaker, can the Minister for Health and Safety state if any investigation of accidents at work has been carried out in February 2012 by the factory inspector showing the industry group involved and whether such investigation may have led to prosecution or to changes to the workplace involved?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services.
No, Mr. Speaker, no accident investigation has been carried out during the requested period.
Question 310, the Honourable J.J. Nettle.
Speaker, can the Minister for Health and Safety state if there have been any reported accidents at work during February 2012 showing the industry group involved and stating which ones were reportable, major and fatal, if any?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, it is premature to provide an answer to this question as the collating of the notification of accident reports for the month of February has not been completed.
Question 311, the Honourable J.J. Nettle.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health and Safety state how many site meetings and advice were given to the factory inspectors during the month of January and February 2012, broken down by month and by industry group?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested by the Honourable Member is contained in the schedule, which I now hand over to him.
Question 312, the Honourable J.J. Nettle.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health and Safety state how many prohibition and improvement notices were issued in the month of January and February 2012, if any, broken down by month and industry group and specifying the reasons for issuing the notice and the period which may have brought operations to a halt until the inspector was satisfied that the correct standard had been duly complied with?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Traffic, Health and Safety and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested by the Honourable Member is contained in the schedule which I now hand over to him.
Value at least what seems to be emerging here is that there is a preponderance by the factory inspector to inspect or to carry out most of the work, or if not all their time, in terms of the construction industry. There is very little information that I have been able to gather so far whether time is made available by the factory inspector to look to other industry group or indeed any government workplace, because it comes under the definition of their involvement, or indeed any workplace under the Minister of Defence. Therefore, could the Honourable Minister mention whether in the nature of the work that the factory inspectors are conducting, there is a preponderance just to look at the construction industry or to look at every single industry, including Gibraltar government and the Minister of Defence?
The factories inspectorate probably have us put the factories inspectorate with the department that we've got, it's actually two members of staff, because of the amount of work required every time there is an accident at work or what have you, especially with what happened in the North Mole, a vast amount of their time is actually channeled towards preparing for the case. Hence, you know, this is the problem we have with them. But yes, they do tend to be quite strong in terms of the construction, but they also get involved in other. We have involved them in other aspects. We involved them in the GSLA swimming pool to obviously give us a well, no, it was, that was also the other part. They actually went to look at what it was the result of an accident. So to be of no accident both involving persons, those it was a collapse of the duct system, and they were involved in that too.
I accept that, Mr. Speaker, that, you know, obviously, if there is an accident, the factory inspector, by necessity, they will attend and conduct an investigation, and I'm sure they will even have some advice to give to the particular authority management in that particular place. And I also accept the fact that, by tradition, the factory inspector would probably use most of their time to the construction industry, which is one of the industries that tends to have, perhaps, more accidents tend to have, or tend to their employers who seem to cut corners more than others. You know, having accepted all of that and acknowledging all of that, nevertheless, the picture that seems to be emanating is that there's very little time that the factory inspector is dedicating to all the other industry groups, and very little time even to workplaces of the government and the MOD. Is that the case?
Well, it's even worse than that, because of what we inherited. In fact, what this factory, what the factory inspector do is they're just a reactive group. They just respond to accidents and reports. And what is completely lacking is the proactive side of things. And this is unfortunately something which we inherited, and we will be reviewing. But what is another very important part of health and safety is actually, you know, by way of education. And proactively get involved with companies as they set up to give them advice, and all that part of things is also missing. And this is what we've actually come to discover when we took office.
I accept that. But given that in the month of February there were two inspections of the construction industry only, and if I remember correctly, in the month of January was a similar situation that the inspection carried out was also the construction industry. Is there not a picture emerging where the only inspection being carried out month after month after month after month, despite that there's only two factory inspectors, it's only the construction industry? And the point I'm making is, do they have in their sight, whether it's the months of March, April, May, June, July, you know, targeting, as far as inspection is concerned, other industry groups, other workplaces in the government, other workplaces in the MOD? In fact, but in a very similar vein, in the sense that the construction tends to have one of the highest levels of accidents, probably, and I'm talking from memory now, the second one who has the highest rate of accidents in the workplace is the Dry Dogs. I can't remember now the companies working out there. Dry Dog. That by nature as well, by the very nature of the activity that goes on. Now, it would seem to me, you know, at face value, that they would bring their inspections into that also that industry group, because by necessity there's another industry group that requires inspection. So are we going to have a situation emerging where only the construction industry will be inspected?
The Honourable Member has indicated that that is an aspect that is being looked at, and there may be merit in what the Honourable Member opposite is saying, and that is a matter that has been looked at. But it hasn't changed since the 9th of December, so it is exactly the same practice that his government was implementing. It is unfortunate, perhaps, that his government did not give the same level of importance to health and safety issues as we were urging when we were in opposition, than to give, and which we will provide now in government. The Honourable Member will recall that one of the issues that I raised when I was in opposition was the fact that a vacancy for Health and Safety Inspector during the course of his government, a vacancy had been advertised and then removed as a result of somebody who had retired. And on numerous occasions, I asked in this House what was happening, and constantly, for many months, possibly even years, I was told that the whole position was under review. The fact is that the practice continues. The fact is that the department was undermanned, and the fact is that the matter is being looked at the moment with a view to redressing the situation. We have been in office 100 days, 99 days. On Sunday, 100 days. We have done more in 100 days than the government, the previous government, had done in 16 years. In fact, Mr. Speaker, I am very proud to form part of this government, this young and energetic government. And honourable members will have seen only yesterday that we published a list of all the manifesto commitments that we have done in 100 days. 71 commitments already carried out. It is the result of tireless, day in, week out, work by this effective and energetic government. We will continue as we have started, and the results will bear fruit. Not only will we see the fruits of these 3 months, Gibraltar will see the fruits of the next 4 years, and the honourable members will thank us for it.
Mr. Speaker, I fear that the contribution that the Honourable Minister for Justice has just made is just a simple smokescreen not to answer my question. My question is a very simple question which he has not addressed. And the question is whether it is the policy of this government in subsequent months to come that inspection would only be carried out on the construction industry. That's got nothing to do but vacancies and whether they have done so much in 100 days. So the question is, if he wants to address it, or the minister himself, is whether in months to come inspection would just be the construction industry. Yes or no?
No, that is not the policy of the government.
That brings us to the end of answers to oral questions, and now answers to written questions. The Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to table the answers to written questions, numbers W71 to W77 of 2012.
First and second readings. A bill for an act to appropriate further sums of money to the service of the year ending on the 31st day of March 2011. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to appropriate further sums of money to the service of the year ending on the 31st day of March 2011 be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to appropriate further sums of money to the service of the year ending on the 31st March 2011 be read a first time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
The Supplementary Appropriation 2010-2011 Act 2012.
Those listening will forgive me, this is the first time that we do this on this side of the House. I have the honour to move that the House do now adjourn to Thursday, the 29th of March. Speaker, at 9:15.
I now propose the question, which is that this House now adjourn to Thursday, the 29th of March, 2012, at 9:15 a.m. I now put the question, which is that this House now adjourn to Thursday, the 29th March, 2012, at 9:15 a.m. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Passed. This House will now adjourn to Thursday, the 29th March, 2012, at 9:15 a.m.